It's time for Mac Break Weekly. The whole team is here. Jason, Andy, and Alex will answer my rhetorical question. What does Apple have to hide? Is Apple going to have an event this month? And if not, why not? We'll also talk about why you should not take your Apple Watch onto a roller coaster. And a big day for celebration if you're a Mac lover. Just don't call it a notebook anymore. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 839, recorded Tuesday, October 11th, 2022. What is Apple hiding? Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by ExpressVPN. If you don't like big tech tracking you and selling your personal data for profit, it's time to fight back. Get 3 extra months free with a 1-year package when you go to expressvpn.com/MacBreak. And by Worldwide Technology, with an innovative culture, thousands of IT engineers, application developers, unmatched labs, and integration centers for testing and deploying technology at scale, WWT helps customers bridge the gap between strategy and execution. To learn more about WWT, visit WWT.com/twit. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple. Joining us, the official Mac Break Weekly team, Alex Lindsay from OfficeHours.Global and 090.media. Hello, Alex.
Hello, hello.
He is a paper millionaire thanks to his investment 20 years ago.
No, a virtual paper, not even a paper millionaire. Paper millionaire actually has stock in something.
You got nothing.
I got nothing.
You
all
got
I got
good is wishes. Stock. The good wishes. Of what was it called?
Meritocracy.
Meritocracy.
Nice. It was back when you'd give you $1 million and you'd, and it turns out I found that if I invest in a bunch of stocks and then forget about it for 18 years,
buy and hold,
get
baby.
About 26% a year. Should have.
Yeah.
I just wish I had real money back then.
Yep. Yeah. Andy Inoko is also here, a proud member of the middle class at Inoko. com.
You see why people, I don't trim my fingernails. They're worn to nubs by trying to cling to the middle class. I'm still there. They're raw, they're bloody, but they're still
it's
there.
It's a shrinking class, but he's proud to be in it. And Jason Snell from sixcolors.com.
I live in Marin County, so what does that tell you? I tell people I live in Mill Valley, California. They're like, ooh. And I say, oh, no, I live in the flat part by the freeway. And they're like, oh, okay.
But as my good friend, the realtor Ray Brown, always told me, never buy the most valuable house on the block. Always buy the least valuable because you have the biggest growth potential. It's all location, location, location.
That's what I hear.
Yeah.
Here.
We were in Tiburon over the weekend.
Now that's fancy.
That's
yeah.
the fancy part of Marin. Holy yeah. cow.
Oh, it's an escalator. Right? Like Mill Valley is expensive. Tiburon is super expensive. And you're like, oh, well, Tiburon's obviously the boat. But then there's Belvedere. It's like you keep going.
Oh,
and
yeah,
it just,
you can go in wrong.
Eventually, yes. they don't allow you to enter after a while. Yeah. It's just, no, sorry.
Does Mill Valley still have that sign like at the town limit saying proud past home of fictional BJ Honeycutt of MASH?
they're doing a project in a local town square, and one of the suggestions that they were like, make suggestions for what you want. And I said, well, obviously the BJ Honeycutt statue is what should be there.
Hysterical. You guys are such
have all the people that live in Mill Valley. You know, you have Jerry
Well, Mike Farrell is still alive to like be there for the dedication ceremony. You need to
there
have
you.
Him. And we joke about these things, but it's like, imagine being like a little kid and like only knowing pretty much New England. So, oh, Mill Valley. I know there's this town called Mill Valley, California, where BJ Honeycutt comes from. Oh, that's interesting.
That's right.
It joke about it. It puts people on the map, but it does put places on the map.
There's, you know, there's a Mary Tyler Moore statue. There's a Captain Kirk statue. There's like, plenty of precedent.
That's how I found out. Do you realize there's a whole state called Iowa?
Do you know?
I thought it was just Star Trek lore.
In Winslow,
no.
Exactly. I thought it was a planet until I was like 18 or 19.
Oh, Leo, is somebody standing on a corner in Winslow,
there
Arizona?
Is
that happening?
Park called Standing on a Corner, and it has a girl, my lord, is statue in the flatbed Ford.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's apparently, I'm told, by people who live in Winslow, Arizona. Yes, absolutely.
I wonder, did you just take it easy after that? I
mean, then you just take it. Take it easy.
It's a park. It's park, so you just take it easy.
Let me see if I can find.
There's a whole bunch of people.
As long as you don't let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy.
They also do, apparently, a standing on the corner festival.
Yeah. There's a whole bunch of Gen Z's like, what are they talking about? Like, this is all
random. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. There's the flatbed Ford. And here's the pickup. Yep. Look at there. I mean, the statue. And see, it says standing on a corner, Winslow, Arizona. Boy, that's taking your moment of notoriety pretty darn seriously.
You got to work with what you have. Work with what you have.
That's it. There's the corner. That's why they've got that Captain Kirk statue in Davenport, Iowa, too. Same reason.
All right. Has anybody received an invitation to a putative apple? Not putative, putative.
What?
Putative in the mind apple event for next week, next Tuesday. No. So maybe German's right and I was wrong, and there is not going to be a real event.
Yeah.
And in fact, the German says that don't expect iOS 16 for your iPad or iPad OS 16 until October 24th. Because the Apple quarterly results call is the 27th, and so that means apparently that's when they do these things.
Frequently.
Historically.
Yeah, right before the event, yeah.
So you think there won't be an event, or maybe it'll be on the 25th?
Well, I mean, what do we mean by event, I think, is the big question.
Well, like something at the Steve Jobs Theater, like, where people show up. And
yeah, no, I don't think there will be, but I think that they can still do an event in terms of like doing one of their little videos that plays for an hour that everybody goes and sees rather than just dropping a press release. There's another move for them that isn't inviting a whole bunch of people into a theater to watch a video that is streamed live on the internet. Yeah. They can still just run a video live. And, it'll be interesting to see if that's what they do or if they just drop press releases, because I think the video is way more effective because they get to force people to watch a commercial for an hour. What could be better if you're Apple?
Yeah.
I mean, the question would be, what could they be releasing in hardware that would merit, hey, we want people to have it. We want analysts and pundits and video and YouTubers to have a chance to actually lay hands on physical product and see something versus, no, we've just, it's the same box, same shape, same specs. Just when you do benchmarks and you do stuff, it'll run faster and you can attach more screens to it, but pretty much that's it. So yeah, that's, I'm starting to feel more and more like that's a really good, good prestige education. Although it's really changing like my schedule for the month, because now it's like every day it's like wake up, see if there's a press release in my inbox about a brand new Mac Mini. If not, I go back to sleep. If there is, I quickly go to the Apple Store and do my pre-order. So that's me for the next 3 weeks.
All right, I felt like there was so, like, the M2 Pro and Max and maybe an Ultra and tease of a Mac Pro.
Something might get released this fall. It just may not be in October. Like,
no, I know, but I mean, stuff. I feel like it was worth an event. That's all I'm saying. I mean, I know they'll release it, but I feel like it was worth an event.
Again, what's an event, though? Like, I really could make the argument that if they do a one-hour video that they tell people about a few days in advance.
That's an event, I guess. Yeah.
That's an event, and then they just, for the press, they would just do briefings instead of having everybody come at once, which is, iPhone event, I mean, we didn't see anything other than Tim Cook showing up at the beginning and saying, hi, everybody, watch my video. Everything else was literally, we were just watching what we could have watched at home on the live stream. The value, as we said the other week, is that the members of the media got to like see the hardware and all that. Well, the other way you can do it is literally invite your reviewers who are going to be getting their hands on the hardware to come to Cupertino or New York or you know, wherever else they do a briefing and give them the briefing. And, you know, just do that and run the video anyway. Like that, there's no appreciable difference in that, I think.
Yeah, but the difference is that there's when you can have like 500 people at least invited to this event, and so 500 people to hundreds more in the demo room, and 500 people, hundreds more writing and doing videos based on, hey, here's my experiences with blah, blah, blah. Whereas you'll have maybe a 24 people who are going to be who are gonna be in the pre-briefings, and most of them are going to be locked into an NDA that says you can't publish anything for another week. This is why the demo room has a kind of a double value. It allows the people who are under NDA to have, guess what, you can get the day of announcement video in and hands on, but in, unbeknownst to anybody else, hey, guess what's in my backpack right now as I'm shooting this video, the exact same thing. So the question is what is Apple's goal for PR and marketing and messaging off of such an event? And I think the question would be, in October, if it truly is rumored that, if the rumors are true and truly the big shot is going to be a new Mac Mini, maybe an updated iPad, and all both in both cases pretty much just new silicon and not brand new silicon we haven't seen before, what would be the value in doing that?
Well, the value
I think
is
the MacBook Pro is out there. That would be new silicon.
The value is you have the attention. Even if Apple were to announce iPod socks, you have the attention of the press and and to a great degree the public. That is, I mean, how much money do you spend for a Super Bowl ad? You're talking that level of attention. Why would you turn it down? Why would you dismiss it?
Well, it gets back into, if you go back to the well too often without something that's worth going to, then press is less likely to come the next time.
Don't give me a break. The press will go to anything Apple
free food.
Ever does.
For now.
Free food, they'll be there.
For now.
But it's levels, and Andy's right. Like, there are different levels here. When Apple did the 16-inch MacBook Pro in 2019, that was my last sort of in-person Apple briefing in the old style before COVID. I mean, that was... a bunch of people got invited the day before the announcement under embargo. We were given the hardware with an embargo time, and then they did a big announcement, and the big announcement came with Apple's announcement plus a whole bunch of media writing stories about the 12 hours that they spent with the hardware in advance. And you can do that sort of scenario if you want to.
But that was
and
one
with this new
device.
They're well, yeah,
do
but
that
I mean,
and a 14.
But if they're no different hardware, right? If it's really, like Andy said, a silicon difference and a Mac Mini bump, and it's a nice collection. But what I'm saying is, there's not much difference. Like, inviting people to Cupertino, it's just there's not that much difference between that and running a video online. I think the question is, are you running a video or are you just doing a press release? Because I don't know why you wouldn't do a video regardless, but I don't think you necessarily need.
I think you want
people
an event
in person
with a date and a time, and you make a big splash out of it.
Yeah, but they've done that during COVID.
That
they did that during COVID. You don't have
COVID.
To invite people. You don't have to. No, I don't. I really don't agree. I think it doesn't matter if you invite the press to the campus.
Here's the link bait article.
If you say Tuesday at 10 a.m. we're going to do a great event, and it's entirely just a video that runs online, I think that is all they need to do.
If I were writing a link bait article for Forbes, the headline would be, "What is Apple afraid of?" by Leo Laporte. No event? Why not?
And then the first line answers the question by simply repeating the headline and removing the word "by."
Leo Laporte. Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's what they're afraid of. No, I think... I just don't think it's a sensible marketing strategy. And look, we know they have at least four products they're going to announce: a MacBook Pro 14, a MacBook Pro 16. All right, maybe it's the same old design. Although, remember, the MacBook Air is not. But okay, maybe it's the same old design. An iPad, that is an important product for them. An iPad Pro, that's an important chance for them to position the iPad Pros. That's four products. Not one 16-inch laptop. That's four products.
Okay. What is gained by having the press watch the video on a screen at Apple Park while
attention?
Well, not
headlines.
You think there are no headlines if they do it the old way that they did during the pandemic
and
just running it online?
Not the same kind of headlines. If it's date and time, if it's look, obviously I'm wrong, but I think it's, from a marketing point of view, it's a very odd thing to do. And the only reason I can think that they would not do it is if there's something they want to hide. If it isn't as big an event as it ought to be. If supply chain shortages or disputes with TSMC or whatever are hurting them.
I mean, I think bottom line, it's that the Mac and the iPad aren't as big as the iPhone. And I mean, they used to do iPhone events at Yerba Buena and do Mac events in Town Hall in Cupertino, which was a much smaller venue. That was a similar choice, which is we don't need to do 100% full effort for Mac speed bumps.
So your guy's position is a processor refresh would just result in negative PR. People would go, no, Apple.
No, that's no. But my idea is that, though, even if you're just running a video, getting the space together, putting an hour and a half of Tim Cook's time on his schedule, that's all. There's a lot more investment behind.
Well, let Johnny Cerruggi do it, or Eddie Q. What's Eddie Q doing these days?
But then it feels like you're minimizing the thing anyway. Yeah. And I don't think they would be suspicious if they didn't decide to do like an actual event. I'm just saying that. I think they have to spend that kind of stuff wisely. You're obviously going to want to do that for Apple Watch, iPhone, certainly for AirPods. Those are Apple's least expensive and really consumerish driven items, where the people who are going to be rushing out to buy this are the people who are probably going to find out about it first on TikTok, like on Instagram stories, on like really, really quick hit.
Maybe it video. Is an acknowledgement, as the White House has even acknowledged, that people get their news in a different way these days. They get it from TikTok. Well,
TikTok is a lot more important than people think. A certain generation is even using it instead of Google for search, for actual
I had
search.
A debate with my daughter yesterday. I said, "What, people aren't searching TikTok in the same way they would search Google." She said, "Dad, you're doing it wrong." I said, "No, really. How could they be doing?" She said, "Dad, you just don't understand." She almost said, "Okay, boomer." I said, "Well, what if I wanted to know how old the Golden Gate Bridge was? I would Google that. You would Google that, right?" She said, "No, you go to TikTok, and then you get and she was right. I did it. You get all these really great historical pieces of. See, my problem is, and she says, your problem is you don't fight the algorithm. My problem is I go with it. She says, you can't go to TikTok and just be pleasured by it. You have to quickly swipe away from anything that isn't something you want, like information. You can't just say, oh, that's kind of funny. Look at it, he's taping her to the wall. Because you're going to get more of that if you do that. So she says you can make TikTok useful or have multiple accounts. Is that what you're about to say?
I have six accounts.
Yeah.
I have six accounts.
You have different accounts for different needs.
Some of them are really funny. Some of them are very focused on how-tos, and some of them are, and I'm very careful. Like, I'll be sitting there and my kids will want to watch something again, and I'll be like, that's the wrong account. I can't do that again. Like, I can't watch that.
I will give you my reason for Apple. And by the way, it's not too late for me to be wrong. Or you guys to be right. But I think there's still a chance that the 24th or 25th, they're not going to do this.
Holding out hope.
Yeah, I'm holding out hope. But look at this. Ed Hardy writing Cult of Mac. Mac shipments shoot up a whopping 40%. This is in a market where PC shipments are down more than they have ever been in history. And look at the headline here. The July launch of the sleek M2 MacBook Air helped surely to push up Mac shipments last quarter. So make a big deal about it. You are riding the wave, baby.
So
if you're surfing and the wave is coming, you don't just go, yeah, have a nice time, wave, and paddle out farther.
Well, that's what they'll definitely do at their earnings call. I will point out that there was another study that said that it was flat and another study that said it was down, because these studies kind of make things
Apple doesn't
up.
Say. Yeah.
But I want to – here's a hypothetical for you about this. How important is this thing? Should it be an event? Is one of the great advantages of having people at Apple Park in person is to get their hands on, like we said, the hands-on area, and you get to see it. Well, theoretically, if the Mac Mini is a speed bump and the Mac Mini hardware didn't change and the MacBook Pro hardware didn't change, it's just got the M2 chip in it, and the iPad didn't change, it's just got a new chip in it, the iPad Pro, let's say. Well, why are we even there, right? Like, it's like, if it's everything you've seen before and the chips changed, is there benefit in having people have their hands on? I just feel like Apple's got more than one event in its playbook. It's got the kind of big event, it's got this kind of virtual event, and then it's got the press release. And this feels like a middle event to me. But hold out hope. They could do something. It seems like it would happen. Have happened in the last hour, probably. If it was
No, I think it's probably not going to happen. But
it's a pretty big lift to bring people to the campus. Like, it's not a minor thing to say, oh, we're going to have people come in. Yeah. And you know, they've definitely figured out the video release process. I definitely agree that if there's no major change to the form factor, it doesn't really mean that. I mean, it is an enormous. I mean, I've worked on a bunch of different keynotes for a lot of different companies, and bringing people in is, you know, 10 times more complicated than just playing out the video.
But it's not like they don't have plenty of money. I mean,
it's a limited number of people. Like you have a lot of money, but it's not.
They just hire you, Alex. 090 Media. Go out and get Alex Lindsay. He can do it. He'll do it for $5 million.
That's a lot. Exactly. It's not sure. Absolutely. I just want to underline that.
If you it's want not to that hard, is it, Alex? Suddenly got easier, didn't 100%
it? 100% in. But it's dealing with it's the security, it's the infrastructure,
yeah,
it's egress, food, everything.
And it
lights
a tacit
up like 150 people.
So this is a tacit admission from Apple that what we got is just kind of more of the same. So we're not
always. Every time we watch it, when we do the office hours thing, when they say this is the best iPhone ever, we're just waiting for someday for them to say, this one wasn't as good as last year, but it was
always
hard
better.
And, we're doing the best we can.
We realize we'd take a lot of crap if we didn't release something, and some of you are dumb enough because we're pretending.
You guys are making my case.
They just need to get Larry David up there and be like.
Part of them calibrating the message is that the iPhone, it's not the iPhone. And so, they don't invite the same people to a Mac event than they do to an iPhone event. They just don't, because those people, if you invite them and it's just the Mac and the iPad, they're going to be like, why did I fly all this way? Right? So you've got it's a smaller group of media who are interested and they're less interested. And that's nothing bad about the Mac and the iPad, but the Mac and the iPad aren't the iPhone. So maybe a smaller event is a better
fit. They have had Mac and iPad events in the past.
They definitely have. I think COVID has changed their strategy.
So they have a new mindset.
Yeah, in the old time, they might have taken us to Brooklyn or whatever, right? Like they did back in 2018 said, oh, here we are and check this out. And I think and this is a question, this is something for us to watch over the next couple of years, is did COVID teach Apple that there are a whole bunch of things that they used to do as events that they should just do as videos?
I sure hope so.
Sure, I feel like tech companies are becoming enervated in this post-COVID era. You look at Google's event last week, which was very much, we're tired, but we did.
I don't know. I thought it was pretty good, and I thought it was kind of like
you were there with me. So
where was that, Andy? Where was that? Where was the?
You
event?
Were in Brooklyn, actually. You were
it
there.
It was in Bed-Stuy. Yeah, it was at they found it. They had a venue that was just like a couple blocks away from the new Google store. The app they opened in Bed-Stuy. It was only like about 100 people, so it was
cool,
like a small
space,
small art space. Yeah. It was a cool space. I like the way that they present. I like the way that they presented it. Like obviously they had already taken the covers off of the Pixel Watch. Like I'm actually wearing it right now, and the new phone.
So let me see. They didn't have to. Don't just throw that up in the air and then.
Yeah. See,
an Apple event, but so it doesn't have an always on display.
Well, you can have it. You can turn it always on if you want.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. See. But yeah, very. I mean, we can talk about it if you want. If we want, But they even do NDAs differently. So this is I'm under NDA, but the NDA basically says you can show it, you can have it, you can take pictures of it. Up until tomorrow, you can do like quick takes on it. I was like the very next morning, I was on NPR like showing it off and giving a quick take on it. You just can't do anything in depth about it. But the presentation was just different from the way that Apple does a presentation.
It was low energy though, but Rico Sulo.
Here's the point. What I liked about it is that they spent the first 15 minutes not showing off like here is a dramatic 3D like reveal. It was here's our approach to this whole line. Here's why we call something a pixel. Here is what we want to do with the entire line.
It was
line.
Aimed
here's
at engineers.
What we want to do with this.
It was an engineer.
It was aimed at the people, I think, in the room who were about to write about this, as opposed to sparkle, sparkle, sparkle. Ooh, applause break, applause break, applause break. So I just don't think it was low energy. It was all live.
There was one recorded piece, but for the most part, it was live.
One executive who Skyped in whatever.
Apple can't go back to all live because the energy that you're talking about, I don't think they were tired. I just don't think you can keep up the pace that
it's
can do with the video.
Yeah, you can't.
And
do
so
it.
The thing is that once you tighten that video up and once you have it all there, and I think that, it does stage presentations feel about 1/10 the energy as something that you just tighten all up. It's the same, it's a, someone presenting, but now we're cutting quickly. They have a perfect take every time. They're able to move through things. We can add effects. We can do all the other things. And even though Apple's feels like it's a stage experience, it was that slow before. We just now are used to the new pace because it's all video.
Right.
And hope, and I think that a lot of other companies are going to keep learning that because the stage thing is, as someone who sat through hundreds and hundreds of them streaming it's
And can I say it was kind of embarrassing, that element of Apple's live presentations. Ooh, applause! Ooh, like okay, this is not the Ellen show. Everyone's not getting a free like 48-inch like HD TV. Just take your notes, observe, be skeptical, be ready for the break.
The people applauding were not those people. The people applauding absolutely. Were the Apple VIPs and Apple employees seated at the front of this theater with the best seats, so that they would be essentially instructed when to applaud because it was showbiz, right? They just wanted applause sounds, so they got them.
That's why I said it's embarrassing, like to want to basically create this high energy. Oh my God, everybody's so excited about this. Aren't we lucky to be here? It's like, dude, you're a $2 trillion company that's trying to sell a $1,200 phone. Perspective. Let's just have perspective.
But I think that a lot of that, again, is going away. I mean, I think that it's going to slowly wind itself out. It was something that Steve Jobs was really good at, and almost nobody else is. And so the thing is that everyone else tries to do what Steve Jobs was doing. I think that the keynote became what it is because of Steve Jobs. It became this giant thing. And I think other people have tried to reproduce it. And I think we're, especially now after COVID, when we realize, videos are a lot easier than this, that the chances of us going back, I think we'll just keep on finding more and more people going to video because it just makes a lot more sense. It's better for the.
I don't know if they're easier, right? Consumers. I mean, it's not that they're easier. It's that they're way more effective, especially if you're not Steve Jobs. And I think you're right. I really wonder if Apple, I used to theorize that Apple might do like a little rapper that was live. So like at an event like the iPhone event or WWDC, they'd come out on stage live and then they'd play a lot of videos, but there'd be little interstitials and they'd let the crowd noise through and stuff like that. I'm not sure that's ever going to happen. I feel like maybe the model is now set, which is they're just going to do videos, and Tim Cook called it a film, right? It's like, so we make films about our,
is that what he
our
said?
Products every year. Yes, it's our film. It's a film. Yes, it's the Apple Film Festival. Aww, enjoy.
How cute.
But it's more effective. It's faster paced.
It's way more fun to watch.
Yeah. It's a better product. And it is marketing. That's what it's for.
Well, thanks to AI Steve Jobs, they could bring him back. I listened to this morning. It was very strange. There's a new podcast called podcast.ai. And the first episode is a virtual Steve Jobs and a virtual Joe Rogan interviewing, or as they call him, Bro Jogan or something. And let me cut to where they're actually starting to talk, because it's kind of interesting. Do you have my audio?
So without further ado, my friend, who is difficult to describe and wonderful, and I'm so grateful he came on the show.
How's it going? Good to see you, buddy. It's been a long time since I've been on the show. I miss this.
Yeah.
It's always fun.
How's it going? Come on. Tell me about Jobs. It's always good to see you, buddy. I'm so happy you came on, man.
Yeah, it's great to be on the show. Your audience is just so different from your normal Apple users, and that's a good thing. It's cool.
Well, you know, I was an Apple user way before I did this show. I've been a fan of yours and Macintosh since the 1980s.
So there, that was, believe it or not, that was synthesized. They say AI, although if you listen to it, there's bits and pieces from actual things Steve said. But so they, I don't know if the AI went through and got like everything Steve ever said and then kind of like Stable Diffusion incorporated.
Well, the part where he does the ad read for Ridge Wallet, that was definitely a synthesized Steve Jobs, I think. That is weird as hell.
Isn't it weird? I mean, it sounds like him, doesn't it? Both of them.
It's weird. Yeah. It's maybe actionable. We'll find that out. That's part of the excitement of this podcast, I think, to find out who gets sued.
Yeah, who gets sued by whom? In the actual audio, he never says, "I'm talking to Steve Jobs."
And they can't do half the things we said.
But the title of the show is Joe Rogan Interviews Steve Jobs.
It allowed us to change our story. We went from being a failed company just trying to get something out to being the younger, cooler alternative to IBM. That was a great blessing. But if Windows had come out a year before, we would have been toast. IBM would have eaten our lunch.
Do you think you'd have done a better version of Windows or work with it?
No. That's the problem I've always had with Microsoft. In many ways, they're smart people and they've done good work,
this is an
but they've
actual
never
quote.
Had any taste.
See, that's an actual quote, right? So I guess the AI found it and did it in the training.
Yeah.
Or maybe. What I don't know, and it's not clear from the podcast AI folks, is did they type in the dialogue and then have the voices?
I think they had an AI generated a script.
That's
that,
what
that
I
they
think.
Then yeah. used their yeah, AI voices for, yeah.
Right.
That's what it
and
is.
And just a hint for you guys, podcast AI, room tone. Just add some room tone.
Exactly.
It wouldn't sound so choppy.
You could certainly tell that that the AI was trained on Joe Rogan on a studio mic versus it was trained on Steve Jobs in a theater.
It's still amazing, right?
It's still
uncanny.
If
you've got isolated audio, right? Like Leo, you have left thousands of hours of your voice,
tens of thousands,
all around the internet. So retirement plan, just to get that stuff trained, and then you can go on vacation, and we won't even know.
There's some incentive for people to do it with Joe Rogan and Steve Jobs. There's zero incentive. Nobody wants an autonomous Leo roaming the internet. So I always thought it would be a good idea. I could retire early, but. This is
any
weird. This
aesthetic is... sense. And I think that's because the people who founded the company in most cases were fundamentally mathematicians and scientists, and they don't understand.
So where it's showed, though, is how close now we can get voices. You could, there's an uncanny valley here. You can hear it and kind of know, oh, yeah, that's fake. But that could be fixed.
And it is the AI doing. I mean, this technology is actually primitive compared to what they're using for like Darth Vader's voice in the Obi-Wan show on Disney Plus, where they use that re-speecher and they took all of the James Earl Jones dialogue and they did an AI model. But they also modeled, I believe, an actor doing the intonation and then they matched it. And so you have the idea where you're trying to get it exactly right. And this doesn't sound as good as that because it seems like it's much more like a text-to-speech synthesis where it's just like, it is good to be here with you.
And like anything else, I mean, when we started having synthesizers do instruments, we were like, wow, that sounds really weird. And then we got used to those as that's what we heard. And then they sounded exactly the
now,
same.
Now, good like luck piano, knowing. You know? Is that a real piano? Is that a fake piano? So this
it just takes time.
A podcast. I'll give him a plug. Podcast.ai, a podcast entirely generated by artificial intelligence. And this is their first episode. A good choice. Rogan and Jobs. But I presume they'll do others down the road. And they say the voices are powered by Play.ht. Play.ht, I guess.
Yeah.
AI-powered text-to-voice generation.
And some of the stuff that, you know, I think we've talked about a little bit in the past, but I know we're talking about it in office hours, is the where this is really, where we're going to see it probably first is in the dubbing for movies. So a lot of people are working on this right now, where you have a model of Tom Cruise's voice, which we've already shown that we can reproduce, but you take all the intonations in his voice and give it, you just type in the translation and it gets all of the intonations correct for French or German or Chinese or whatever. And then it also can change his lip shapes. So it can put the dub in. It can not sound like someone who sounds like Tom Cruise, just is a Tom Cruise generation. And then it also fixes his mouth so that it looks like it's saying that as well. And that's probably one of the first places we're going to see it at a production level, you know, where there's a lot of money going into that right now because it saves a lot of money, you know, down the road too.
I just spent $1,700, on something that's not from Apple, but I'll talk about that when we come back.
Weird.
What could it be? Now that they're not having an event, well, screw it. I was holding that money for M.2 16-inch MacBook Pro, maybe an N.2 Ultra, but I guess they're not releasing one, so I have something else to spend that money on now. Now it's time to talk about our fine sponsor. We'll have more with Mac Break Weekly. Yes, we'll have more Apple stuff, promise you. Steve Jobs is kind of Apple, right? That counts. Our show today brought to you by ExpressVPN. Oh, what a world we live in these days. Profiling, surveillance, data harvesting. Did you see our interview with Cory Doctorow and Rebecca Giblin about their book Choke Point Capitalism? It's depressing. It's depressing. Or surveillance capitalism with Shoshana Zuboff, another triangulation. There are a lot of things, you know, to kind of go, wow, these tech giants, they really are invading our privacy. But, you know, there is something you can do about it. Not give up Google. No. Not spend $44 billion to buy Twitter. No. But the good news is you don't have to be a billionaire. You can use ExpressVPN for as little as $7 a month. If you don't like big tech tracking you and selling your personal data for profit, it's time to fight back. That's what I use and recommend to everybody. ExpressVPN is the VPN you can trust. And that's important, by the way. Because if you're using a free VPN or a VPN, you don't know where it came from, they could be just as invasive as big tech. Worse, frankly, they could be selling your stuff to data brokers, not ExpressVPN. They go the extra mile to make sure that your traffic is not logged. They cannot log it. There was a great article in Bleeping Computer about ExpressVPN and the custom Debian distro they wrote and the custom server software they wrote called Trusted Server. That runs in RAM. When you press the big button on your ExpressVPN app, and they have apps for every platform, you spin up a server in RAM just for you, and it's sandboxed. It can't write to the disk. It can't log your presence. And when you close the VPN, it goes away, poof, and there is no trace. And that Debian distro reboots every morning to a brand new, fresh installation with a fresh and erased hard drive. That's why in years past, when authoritarian regimes have seized ExpressVPN hard drives, they found nothing on them. No information about their customers. That's why I like ExpressVPN. Avoid being tracked. Use ExpressVPN to eliminate geographic restrictions, that kind of thing. And, of course, use ExpressVPN for your security when you're at an open Wi-Fi access point. And it's so easy. You put ExpressVPN on your iPhone or your Android phone, your Mac, your PC, your Linux box. You can even put it on many routers. Push a button or turn it on, and then all of a sudden your traffic is encrypted from your computer to the ExpressVPN servers anywhere in the world. You get to choose, although they will, if you don't expressly say, they'll choose the nearest server, the fastest server close to you. If you don't like big tech tracking you and selling your personal data for profit, here's a way to fight back. ExpressVPN.com/MacBreak. 3 months of ExpressVPN free when you buy a one-year package. Brings it down below $7 a month. I'm telling you, that's a very fair price because they invest that right back into the servers, so they have lots of speed for you. They refresh their IP addresses. So it's a fresh IP address, which is great because then you can't get fingerprinted as a VPN user. It's really important that you use a VPN provider that invests in their infrastructure. ExpressVPN does. ExpressVPN.com/MacBreak. ExpressVPN.com/MacBreak. We thank them so much for their support of MacBreak Weekly and invite you to try it out. I like it.
I like it.
All right. I'll tell you what I spent my money on. Today, Meta had a big event. I bet you, Alex Lindsay, you kind of watched this, paid attention to this.
Yeah, it looks cool.
This, you know, it's germane to the Apple discussion because Apple keeps saying AR, AR, AR. I guess they're not going to announce anything this year, maybe next year. Meanwhile, Meta is saying as quickly as we can, look, Facebook's failing. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. Their stock price is tumbling. People are leaving them in droves. Yeah. Right. They need a next act. And Mark has said $10 billion a year, thousands of engineers, we're going into the metaverse. Alex?
And it's going to take that kind of work to figure it out. You know, like it's mm-hmm. there's a lot to be figured out, in that area. And we see them making progress, you know, along that path. And I think that they also have to make progress in trust because people are going to spend a lot of time in there. But I think that the one of the interesting things about what we saw with the new headset is that I think that they found that they didn't sell that many more by making it less expensive. Like, you know,
One's $1,500.
Yeah, going down in price did not really help them. I think it didn't really, they just found the same number of people would buy it at $1,500 that would buy it at $300.
Well, and that maybe you need to spend that kind of money to really have a headset that's worthy. Yeah. Right?
I mean, I think that Microsoft has done a really good job, you know, with, with their goggles, you know. So
well, that's what's interesting. Aren't they pairing, teaming with Microsoft for this?
I think they're doing some stuff with them. Yeah. But Microsoft has done a much better job of going top down. Let's figure out what the technology needs to do, and then eventually we'll figure out how to do it affordably. And I think that a lot of folks were trying to figure out, well, if we just get to the mass market, we can get this off the ground. But the problem is that a lot of the tools, it's a really hard thing to develop for still. And so there's a lot of bits and pieces that still have to put together. So I think that that's the real challenge for them. And so I do like the fact that they're making a higher performance version that people can use. I don't think it's going to affect the number of sales. It'll just affect revenue positively.
Well, and also notice if you go to the page, meta.com/quest/quest-pro, this is the new one. There's not a lot of gaming going on here. This is right. They're pushing this as something to design cars with, to teach school remotely with, to meet with clients. There's no gaming here.
Yeah. Alex has a wonderful on point there, because HoloLens is a success because there are people who the people who are willing to buy virtual reality, augmented reality headsets are the people that aren't going to blink at $1,500, $2,000, $3,000 for HoloLens because they're military, they're industrial, they're doing they're engineering. They have specific uses that have to have demanding technology that this has to do. They can't really do anything with a $350, $450 headset. But if you give them something that can actually be used to take the to handle most a lot of the paperwork they have to do, handle a lot of the training that they have to do, handle a lot of the exercise they have to do, that's worth four times what they're going to pay for it. And it is the development of the higher end headsets that are going to create a future 5 years from then that can create the $500 headset with apps and utility that are actually going to be relatable to normal humans. Because that's still like the big puzzle that Apple has to solve. They can create the technology. They can create a dazzling demo. They can create something that is really, really cool looking to put on your face. But at the end of the game, are they going to create a reason for people, ordinary people who aren't necessarily or aren't buying these $2,000 headsets on impulse? They're buying it because I want this thing. I see a role for this in my life. Are they going to find that role for this in people's lives beyond playing a lightsaber, whatever game?
Beat Saber. Sure. Yeah.
You know, I should be clear that you could still play Beat Saber with this. It's
exactly.
Even though they don't mention it until the very bottom, they show some of the things you can do. It works with all your previous stuff. But they're really pushing this as a pro product.
I don't think I entirely agree with Alex that everybody who bought it would have bought it at $1,500. Because I can tell you, I bought a Quest 2, and there's no way in hell I would have bought a $1,500.
And they're still
headset.
Selling the Quest 2.
No way. But I do think it is wise. I do think I use it all the time, and it's fun.
Okay.
I really, and it's a lot of fun. I don't really agree on that point, but I think strategically what they're doing is part of this is fear of what Apple's going to do. But also I do agree. I think the idea is it's probably better to build an aspirational product that's overpriced that cracks the case to make it more appealing for people, like the full color pass through. So you can do essentially augmented reality inside a VR headset. Not as an overlay, but as like you're seeing the real world through a camera, but then they can also draw things on top of it.
That's what they say in the specs. Full colored mixed reality with a resolution 4x higher than the Quest 2. So you're still in the world. You're seeing it through cameras. It's not optical. How does it work on the Quest 2? Does it work pretty well?
It feels like you put the ring on, like you're a hobbit with the ring on.
Yeah, it's grainy black and white. It's amazing it works at all, but it is super grainy black and white. It's not great. It means basically it's so you can walk around without dying, without taking off your headset, but that's about all it's for. But this is, so I think Meta is smart in doing this because this is obviously Apple strategy, and I think that it's probably a smarter strategy, even if $1,400 is a lot for a headset and $2,000 maybe for Apple's headset. Is way too much for a headset. If you can make something that cracks it in terms of oh, I see why you might want to use this. And then you can figure out ways to scale it down and increase how many you're selling so you can, you know, you can reduce the cost to make them and then you can lower the price. Like, that's probably a more effective strategy than what Meta was doing with the Quest, which was starting it low and hoping to get it better over time. Because, yeah, a mediocre VR experience and a bad mixed reality experience isn't going to sell anybody.
That's why I ordered this, because I know this isn't going to be the end game. For Apple or for Meta. But, and in fact, probably they could charge whatever they want, because the whole idea is, let's show you what's possible. And then you get a few people saying, hey, this is really great. This works. And that's the goal, right?
And that's what Microsoft's done with the HoloLens. And it's just, they've done some stunningly good work in that area, where some of the architectural stuff, the AEC solutions, where you can put it on and you can see where the building is from the scans and see a lot of those things integrated. I think that they've done some of the best work as far as not being constrained by cost and just saying, this is what this thing needs to do right now. And eventually we'll figure out how to make it less expensive.
That's
but right now,
we've got
to figure out how to make it work.
Apple do that? Yeah.
I think the HoloLens was even more than that. They went, I think at some point $6,000 or something like that.
No, it's cheaper than that now, I think.
They started off pretty high and just saying, well, this is what it costs to get it done and figure it out. And again, for military projects, for AEC, for a lot of the other things that they were using it for, it was fine. You know, whatever that cost was worth it. But I think that I think Apple will probably come in from the top, not trying to grasp at how to make this ineffective, because we don't even know how to make it work yet. Like, that's the big problem is that we don't even know what it takes. And so you're trying to solve too many variables at one time when you're trying to make it $300.
Currently, HoloLens 2 is $3,500 unless you want to wear a fancy helmet with it. The Trimble version is with a hard hat integrated HoloLens is $5,100.
I think that might be what I was thinking, because the ones that I've been looking at are connected to Trimble, because Trimble does a lot of the architectural engineering construction type stuff. And so the Trimble one is the one that I've seen in the past. And it's a pretty impressive solution.
A hard hat integrated HoloLens 2 that's purpose built for personnel in dirty, loud, and safety controlled worksite environments. And of course, they've sold more than $1 billion worth to the U.S. Army. Initially weren't too happy about this, but they're still going ahead with it.
Beyond just the safety issues, I think we might have talked about this before, but training people, being able to train people without having to spend, you know, $30,000 an hour or $40,000 an hour on an aircraft, you know, it is, you know, that really knocking down those hours by giving people something that really feels like they're almost there. It's not going to be the replacement for doing it in the real world, but it is a place where you can get people to get a sense of where things are in space and figure those things out before they put themselves in harm's way or they spend a lot of money per minute to figure it out.
Yeah, when they launched the Dragon crew last week, they mentioned that these guys had trained for this, including all the sounds. They recorded previous launch sounds and pumped them in so that they wouldn't be surprised by that sudden bang, bang, bang. Yep. And they said, of course, there's nothing like the real thing. But I think that does go a long way towards training you for.
As the saying goes, NASA spent more money on the fake Apollo missions in simulation than the Soviets did on the actual lunar space programs.
Right. Training is very important. Yeah.
Baseball is a place where they're doing this too, believe it or not, because you can't get, so they can model pitches and, you know, it's all repetition, right? You're trying to teach batters how to read pitches coming out of the hands of pitchers, but you don't have that pitcher. So how do you do it? And the answer is that they use VR to do pitch recognition and swing tracking and all these things, which again, it's not cheap, but it's cheaper than hiring pitchers or building a pitch machine that can do it. And you can have lots of people with headsets on, whereas you might only have a handful of batting cages. And it's for development. I don't think at the major league level as much, but for people who are in college or in the minors, they're using VR for this stuff too. So it's got a sports training angle as well. There's a lot of applications for this stuff.
That's how you get an Aaron Judge with that performance enhancing drugs. you put him in a VR helmet.
Put a helmet on.
Yeah. Interesting. So this is the HoloLens, the Quest Pro 2 specs. It's $1,500. I mentioned that you get full-colored mixed reality, that three cameras in the controllers. Wait a minute. It says Meta Quest Touch Pro controllers includes three cameras and a Snapdragon 662 mobile processor per controller.
Yeah.
Wow. Next generation optics, the optical stack, they've slimmed down by 40% using our innovative patented pancake lens and optics technology. I did not watch Mark introduce this. Did you watch the video this morning? I didn't watch the stream. I should have. Which works by folding light inside the optical module. Advanced VR LCD display technology, 37% greater pixels per inch. That's important, isn't it? You don't want to be able to see those pixels. And a 1.3 times larger color gamut. They have considerable storage, 256 gig storage, 12 gigs of RAM. It's a Snapdragon XR2 Plus processor. You know what? I want, you know, since you've used the Quest 2 extensively, I think it'd be nice, Jason, if you came over and tried the Pro when it comes. It's supposed to.
I'd love to do that.
October 25th.
I'd love to do that.
Come
yeah,
up and do a Mac Break Weekly that day or
and,
something like
and
that.
The Mac, and the Mac Break angle here as well is this, I think, is the headset that Apple's, you know, Apple Reality or whatever they call it will be compared to.
This is the competition,
I think that this will be the sort of what did Apple do versus what this particular product is, because it is playing that, you know, similar rules, right? Which is not worried about the price so much, but trying to figure out if, you know, what would be a productizable high-end mixed reality headset today. And that's really interesting.
You do not need a computer, but you do need a phone, iOS or Android. The MetaQuest mobile app is your two-dimensional window into the world of VR. Use the MetaQuest app to set up the headset, download content, update account info, so you control it. It's the good news is it's not tethered. Bad news is you do have to kind of use some computer to set it up. It's not going to do it on a standalone.
That's really smart. I think asking it to process all that data with at the frame rates, at the resolution that they at the frequency that they need, and not be this battery hogging heat sink on top of your face. That's a bigger problem than they can solve right now, and top the other problems they have to solve. Being able to say, well, let's use another processor that someone's carrying in their shirt pocket. That in itself is a really, really good step.
I don't think that's what they're doing though. I think that it's just for setup and for connecting to you know.
It's
for
not
you to
using
your...
it to play the games, but you have to load them. That's why it has 256 gigs RAM. You have to get the game on your phone and then send it up to the MetaQuest Pro.
I've seen other units like this that are being done, like most that are being done not necessarily on an experimental basis but on a lab basis. And the thing when you read the papers that these people are writing about it, they're saying that we will make any sacrifice whatsoever to maintain to increase the frequency of how we're taking in data from the sensors and the problems that we're having just maintaining battery life and just maintaining a heat threshold that's tolerable are some like the limiting factors that they're dealing with. So I'll change my answer and say I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't judge a VR AR headset maker for saying, guess what, you have to have a phone, it has to have these qualifications, and you have to have it in your shirt pocket at all times.
Right.
Given that they are so focused on this Horizon Worlds thing, which is sort of like put your business life inside VR, which I'm skeptical of, but regardless of that, one of the things that it gets you is if you are pairing your phone to it, what they want you to do is if your text messages come in, if a call comes in, other information from the apps on your phone, when you've got the goggles on, what they want you to do is not take them off to check your phone, right? So by pairing with your phone, they get to pipe all of the stuff that's coming into you via your phone from the outside world into this headset without having to have you log into all of your stuff in the Horizon world or wherever you are.
Yeah, and one of the things that...
Go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
All I'm going to say is that one of the things that we noticed when we started playing with some of this a couple of years ago was that you could take a lot of traditional broadcast, and this is a real problem. People taking the headset on and off really... because it just never comes back the same way, or it was always hard to get it to come back into the same state. It's not like you just lift it off and then pull it back in. You're back where you were. You have to hit a bunch of buttons and do a bunch of other things. And so one of the things that we learned is, A, you know, how do we do golf? So we shot a lot of golf in 360. And the problem really was is that it wasn't that interesting. You still kind of wanted to watch the show that's in 16:9. But if we took all the graphics that we were showing you in 16:9 and put it off to the right Now, anytime you want to see where the, you know, where people are, you just look over and take a look and then go back to what you're watching. So now you have a clear aperture that you could sit there and watch and then look at the data. But then we found that to the left, we started putting, you know, your text messages, your Twitter, everything else. You put it over there so that someone can interact with that when they want to. They can interact with a clean aperture and then they can interact with the data from the event. And so starting to use that data in a bunch of different ways, and it makes it much more immersive, even though it's not 360. It's much more immersive because you don't feel like you have to take you don't have to shift modes very often.
We've seen recent studies that said Horizon Worlds was so awful that Meta employees themselves were not using it. But I'm told, I haven't seen the presentation yet, but I'm told that you do now have legs. So that's a big step forward.
Thank goodness. You know, I don't know if that's a feature. It was kind of nice to float around.
Incidentally,
if I could float, I would float a lot.
The keynote was not live, as far as I can tell. It was streamed. I'm watching it right now. It's a video presentation. So they, I think maybe learned from Apple too. Cause remember that, the keynote that Mark had everybody put on headsets and then he appeared and walked down the aisle and everybody thought it was extraordinarily creepy. I think they maybe learned a little bit. Oh, no, no legs. Sorry. There's still people without legs dancing. Oh shoot. Yeah. I'm disappointed.
See, this is why even Apple it's a brave, brave move. It's natural for them to do. This seems like a product they could do really well. But the thing is, like, Apple has never done a product like this. They've never done a product where there isn't an existing product that people have already embraced and accepted and has already fulfilled a role in their lives. Nobody has a role in their lives for VR, augmented reality. And the first step in this is not going to be getting the hardware out. It's going to be getting enough of the hardware out that developers are now playing with it and they might, and for them to find the app, to find the service, to find the role that will cause people to want to buy even a $1,000 headset and to wear it regularly and to not take it off because they've got a text message or they've got something else going on in the real life. And the thing is, they may not find it. Developers might, even Apple developers, who are some of the most creative and insightful people, I'll say the most creative and insightful people who are coding for any popular platform, they might come up some incredibly great games. They might come out with great training systems that go far beyond any existing corporate and industry and military training systems, but they may not find the thing that makes people think, wow, that is definitely going to be worth $1,000 of my money and I'm definitely going to want to wear this out in public or even around the house. That they may not solve that problem.
I'll go so far as to say, you know, Meta and Apple probably won't solve the problem, right? So it really is incumbent on them to turn loose developers. And that's one of Apple's huge advantages, right, is that Apple has this pool of iPhone, iOS developers that if they can take them and get them motivated to use this thing and to try it out, like, Meta's already learned Supernatural and Beat Saber, right? Like, they're like, oh, this is kind of a killer app. And they're like, we're going to buy them immediately. We need to buy them. But those are two good examples of apps that really hit and hit way more than anybody expected. And that's what the developers bring to the table, is that they're going to have the good idea that's huge. So number one is not like this whole Horizons thing that Facebook is doing or Meta is doing. Like, I don't know. They're trying to make it happen, but it really feels like the innovation that's going to make this stuff work is going to come from someone else, and then they're going to jump on it and buy it.
And a lot of it is also, to get back to what you were saying, is the tools that Apple is slowly building: Reality Converter, Reality Creator, a lot of those bits and pieces to make things super easy to throw things together so that developers don't have to rethink that. I think that Apple doesn't have all the developer tools yet, but they're really building this over years. You know, the process of you getting USDZ, for instance, out there really makes a big difference, because now you have a format that everyone can theoretically use to get all the stuff in there. And even by itself is interesting. I mean, when you look at being able to, I now have, every once in a while I'm on Amazon and I'm looking for something for the house and it says, would you like to see this? And I'm like, oh yeah, sure. And I hit the button and it appears at scale, placed right where I can decide where I want to place it. I was getting a new thing under my TV and to scale, lit, everything else just pops in. And those are the kinds of things that are coming that may not be something that you need to wear all the time, but something you may want to use at certain times.
This will be a good test of the two different ways of developing. You know, Apple famously develops in secret and then reveals the cake fully baked. And that's clearly what we're doing here. They're putting out little bits and pieces, but there's got to be a lot behind the scenes that we don't know about. Whereas companies like Google, and I guess to some degree here Meta, are doing it in public. I think there's an advantage to doing it in public. You get feedback, but you also get arrows in your back. And look at Google with Google Glass. You know, that actually killed the effort them. So
it's interesting you bring that up, because Warren Craddock, who's a Google developer, he actually posted a really nice tweet. Couple of threads yesterday.
Yeah,
exactly. He worked on Google Glass. He also worked on Lytro, and then the light field camera. He also worked on Google Clips. And he basically said that these were all like very researchy sort of things where they never figured out what are people actually going to use this for. Like, what is the, they all had a fatal flaw in them that the team basically said, well, we'll push forward. We'll figure this out all along the way, or we will simply release this in some form and people will tell us what the purpose of this thing is. Google Glass, which I always defend, because I thought that one of the smartest things that Google did about this is not saying, hey, we're releasing this as a commercial product, but saying we're releasing this as an experiment in limited numbers to people who are volunteering to try something that's kind of half-baked. And he's saying that part of their hopes was that if they release this and make this really, really easy to develop software for, maybe the developers will find an app for this or a use for this that will work out. And even they didn't find it. So,
but also Google cut. This is the problem that the developers have. Sorry if I introduced. No, sorry, Andy.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
So I got Google Glass pretty early on, and the thing is that there was something that developers oftentimes will develop something and they don't know how to use it. Like, they don't know what it's useful for. and so they're not paying attention. If you ask them, like, what is this product for? They'll give you a bunch of gobbledygook that doesn't make, you know, like that's what makes sense to them, but it's not condensed. So for instance, with Glass, one of the most powerful things that it had was I can see what I'm shooting. And I can see theoretically you if you were on Hangouts, but they very quickly turned Hangouts off because they were afraid people would do bad things with it. And so they turned off the thing that was like, because when we did it as a test where I can sit there and show you how to use a camera and I can show you how to do something and you can see me and I can see you. And I'm like, no, don't do it that way. Do it this way. It was like this opening up this thing and that no one's ever really opened again. Because other people have done it, but it's just clunky. You know, the Glass was something that just worked. And then the other thing was, is that when you say, okay, take a video, the ability to shoot point of view training and videos on what you're doing, was nothing's gotten close to Glass, in my opinion. There's a lot of headset-based things that I've tested, and you know, none of them are as good as what it was. And so they had things that were really killer and that could have been promoted, but then they promoted all this other stuff that wasn't particularly useful or interesting.
Yeah, they didn't have the story straight. But what I loved about it, I'm talking about from the moment I picked him up in a suite in New York City. An hour later, I was taking a walk through Central Park, and I immediately was so enraptured by the idea that I have this tiny little display that when I need it, it appears. Like, when I want to take a note about something, it appears, and then it disappears, and now it's completely out of my field of vision, and I don't care about it. But Warren Craddock was talking about things like, they couldn't get around the fact that you look like a goofball wearing it, and there was never anything that was so good about it that it would say, it's worth me looking like a goofball walking through Central Park wearing this thing on my face.
Yeah.
But it's going to take a lot of experimentation.
His point in this tweet storm, which is really worth reading, I was saving it for tomorrow for this week in Google. We'll talk about it today too. Was that engineering teams kind of drink the Kool-Aid? They get so invested in their product that they don't see what is an obvious fatal flaw in the product. I think of the Segway, which is a very cool product, but you look like an utter dork on it because you're 8 feet tall. And so the people, you know, people who saw it were all enamored of it, but really kind of didn't see the forest for the trees. He mentions Google Clips, which, remember that? It was a little box.
Yeah.
And you'd clip it on. I got one too. And it would take pictures of your life, and then you would have a photo album of your life.
Weird pictures.
Well, that's what he says. He says, nobody paid any attention to the fact that the angle that you were taking the pictures from was not a normal place, and so you were getting weird pictures, because when we take pictures, we take it from eye view, not chest view. And he said that was obvious from day one, and they never solved it. And you know, he says it was obvious from day one that Google Glass looked dorky and didn't do anything that useful, and Google never found a killer app for Glass. So his point is well taken. I think that you know, this is why you have a company. You don't have, you know, that often these little startups do best, and you mentioned this, Jason, that probably somebody will reinvent, you know, a Meta world, and Meta will buy it because they'll do it better. These little companies have the passion to do it, but it takes kind of an outside eye to turn it to really turn it into something of value.
You also I think the problem particularly with Zuckerberg is that he really Zuckerberg and Elon Musk they have like billionaire psychopath syndrome, which is all I have to do is to stamp my staff into the ground, the lightning will form, and up from this ground will smoke this vision of reality that I am promoting. Where and it's like. No one is going to do that. No one's going to come and switch their entire business to your metaverse simply because you are doing all these demonstrations about how the future is in the metaverse and we're investing in the metaverse. Good for you. Just like you say, I'm going to build an army of humanoid robots that are going to take the place of laborers. They're going to cost $20,000 to $30,000 again. Good for you, Elon. I'm glad you're excited about this. I'm glad you're employing people to work this, but.
That's why we give a lot of credit to Steve Jobs, because I think he was that outside eye who could say, that's crap, don't do that, I don't like that. And, of course, he had the power to enforce it. And I think he made a big difference.
He had good taste.
And he had good taste.
You know, like the thing is, so I think that the thing, and there's a lot of people that would do a lot of things if you gave them a lot of money. And so we just get to see what, there's some people who, you give them a lot of money and they're going to go, well, this is what I really believe is going to happen. But it does take the collating of a lot of people to do it. You do have to sell it. And sometimes you have to be willing to sell it for many years to get it off the ground. So it does make sense that they're trying to do that. But they also have to have something that actually, I think Apple's pretty good at following that up with things that actually do things.
Yeah, has to scratch an itch. They're announcing things like the Horizon Worlds will now be in the web. So you don't have to, you know, it's incremental progress. I think that's interesting. And, you know, I bought the very first, I did the Kickstarter for the Oculus, the very first Oculus, and used that and got a sense of it, didn't keep using it. Michael has the Vive, and we also got the Quest 2 for him because I don't have a Facebook account. Now that I can use it with a Meta account, I think it's time to look at it once again. And I know it won't be done. I know it'll be another, you know, maybe in 5 years we'll look at it once again and we'll have made more leaps along
those. I think the problem for me is that I'm nearsighted. And I don't want to change the lenses out because other people use it. And so it destroyed one of my glasses because I was wearing it. I was doing it every day. Yeah. And then I was like, well, I don't want to do this anymore. And what's I
you
think
wear
the
glasses, Jason. How do you do
I bought the lenses that you pop on top. And so you can take your glasses off and use it. And then, if you've got somebody else using it, you got to pop them back off again.
It's definitely an issue. You know, there's a lot of issues like that. Well, there's nausea. There's another issue. You know, I mean, there's a lot of issues. Well, like
the hard part was I had the gear, and all I had to do with the gear is move the little dial, and I was in focus. You know, like so. The problem was I knew that something else existed. So every time I put the Oculus on, I was like, I don't understand why they didn't give me diopters. You know, like I didn't. Like I just every time I put it on, I was angry. You know, and so then I just was like.
Every time I put it on, I was nauseated. So, you know, similar. Yeah. Jason, you like it, though. You're still playing with the Quest.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, it's a novelty more than anything else.
That's my feeling. It's a novelty.
My big issues with it are that you've got to have, like, look, again, we mentioned earlier, I live in Southern Marin. I live in a small 1950s tract home. I don't have the space to play virtual ping pong without moving furniture,
right?
That becomes it's a problem. That actually, and I think that will be an issue if this does become big. It's like, remember when the Wii came out and they said, well, now you need to clear a 6x8 foot area in order to play. And I'm like, who has a 6x8 foot area empty to play video games in? And that's the biggest problem I have is I have to move stuff around in my
Georgia
house in order
Dow.
To play it. But it's fun.
Georgia Dow.
I have to mention a plug. There's a Reddit called VR to ER. That's nothing but pictures of injuries inflicted by like swinging your lightsaber and hitting a lamp and breaking your hand.
I have to say, one of the things that I found most impressive about the Quest 2 is how they handle that. That they have you sketch out using the mixed reality remote, sketch out the safe spaces, and then it also is recognizing protruding objects, and it like starts to put like a red circle, like this is danger, you're getting too close to the danger zone, and if you go through the danger zone, it actually drops you into mixed reality. So it's like, hey dummy, there's a thing there, don't do that. So it's pretty good at that. But the issue remains where, like, it's very hard to play ping pong. And seriously, 11 table tennis on the Quest 2 is amazing. It really is very, very good virtual ping pong. But if you can't go to your right beyond about, like, you know, 4 feet because there's a bookshelf there or a wall, it's like, it's hard. It's bad for your game is what I'm saying. It's bad for your table tennis game.
One other minor point. I'm looking at the Meta keynote from earlier today. It just ended right before we began. And they're making a kind of a pointed, so I think that that's got to be a MacBook sitting on the table there. And I think that it's very clearly neither a Google Pixel Watch nor an Apple Watch. That's a real watch on that guy's wrist. So I think Meta is taking great pains to make sure that you don't think they use any Apple products, even though I think by far they use more Macs than anything else. All right, let's take a little break. Lots more to talk about. Andy Iannocco is here, WGBH in Boston. Alex Lindsay from 090.media and officehours.global, and from sixcolors.com, the great Jason Snell. You're getting ready your finger trigger fingers on the color graphs button for the October 27th.
Yep, I got my chart scripts all warmed up and ready.
Do you update those ready over time, or are you just kind of it works and
until something screws up? Then yeah, but it's good. It's automated to the point now where I have to put in the numbers and then I run one script and it outputs all the data, which
is
great.
That's a beautiful thing. Beautiful thing. It actually brings us to our sponsor for the hour, Worldwide Technology. If you're in business, when technology works to support your business strategy, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And that's what WWT is all about. They're at the forefront of innovation, working with clients all over the world to transform their businesses with technology. But it's, and I always emphasize this, they are business people. So they understand that it has to support your business. It's not technology for technology's sake. Yeah, they're technologists. They're technologists who understand business. And it all starts at their ATC, their Advanced Technology Center. Lisa and I went out and visited it March 2020. It was the last trip. It was an amazing thing, though. I was so glad we went out. It started 10 years ago, one little building, couple of racks. It now spans multiple buildings, many, many racks, $500 million of state-of-the-art enterprise gear in the lab, from all the leading OEMs and all the disruptors, everybody you'd want to know about. And of course, WWT's engineers use these amazing facilities, this incredible advanced technology center, to spin up proofs of concepts, to do pilots for their customers, to learn about new technologies, to see which technologies integrate well. It's great for WWT. It helps cut evaluation time from months to weeks. But starting last year, they started doing something really cool. They opened up the ATC to you, to anybody, for free. The ATC, the Advanced Technology Center, offers hundreds of on-demand and schedulable labs featuring solutions that include technologies representing the latest advances, the newest stuff in cloud and security, networking, primary and secondary storage and data analytics in AI and DevOps and so much more. And now you can use it to test out products and solutions before you go to market. To get it's not just the labs. You get technical articles, expert insights. You can see demonstration videos and white papers. All the tools you need in your business to stay up to date with the latest technology. And because WWT has virtualized the Advanced Technology Center, members of the ATC platform can access these resources anywhere in the world, 365 days a year. While you're in the ATC, you want to check out WWT's events and communities, too, because they do so many interesting things. We went out there in March to do an event that was really cool, a lot of fun. Mary Jo Foley joined us, as a matter of fact. But they're doing this all the time with very smart people in the arena so that you can learn about technology trends, you can hear about the latest research, get insights from their experts. It's really a community, and I think that's the thing to emphasize, a community of like-minded people, all of whom are trying to understand what's going on in technology and how it can further their business. WWT is the partner you need. Whatever your business needs, they can deliver scalable, tried and tested, tailored solutions to meet your strategy. WWT brings strategy and execution together to make this exciting new world happen. To learn more about WWT, the ATC. To gain access to all these resources free, go to wwt.com/twit. We love these guys. They are just doing some amazing stuff. And man, if you get a chance ever to get to St. Louis to see the ATC, I highly recommend it. It's amazing. But you can do it virtually if you create a free account on the Advanced Technology Center platform. Just go to wwt.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of all of our shows. You support us, dear listener, by going to wwt.com/twit. That lets them know you saw it here. It's very important. So please use that address, wwt.com/twit. Okay, enough Oculus jealousy, enough Oculus envy. Looks like, according to Mr. G, Mark Gurman.
I'm not done, Leo. I'm not done. I'm still looking for... Are we on?
Can I come back?
I put on my headset, but I'm not seeing anything.
It's Jordy.
Are we not in VR?
At least put some of those sticky googly eyes on so we can think that you're still looking at
us. That's a good idea. Okay, I'll do that on my pros.
We can do that in post.
That's or we'll do it in post. Okay. Okay, Jason now has disappeared. I don't know. Did he lose his legs? Did he fall off the chair and he can't get up?
He got attracted to one of those red zones he talked about.
Zuckerberg said, the number one thing people ask of us is legs.
I fell on the floor and didn't have legs. Oh, no.
I couldn't get up.
What was happening there?
So they didn't say when, but they are working on legs at some point.
Well, that's because it's hard to stand without them.
Yeah. Somebody in the chat room is telling me that a famous Mexican actor, Vic867, is telling us a famous Mexican actor who came out in Coda movie, Eugenio Derbez, fractured his elbow and shoulder while playing in VR with his kid.
You got to have space. If you don't have the space, it's going to be bad.
Can't play the game without the space. So according to Mr. G, we will get iPad OS 16.1 2 days before the event, the Apple earnings report, October 24th, or 3 days before. I guess we just got an update to iOS 16. It's 16.03 now, and I don't know what
bunch of new fixes. Betas dropped again. They're in the weekly beta cycle, which really tells you that
they're getting close.
It's coming.
Yeah,
it's coming real soon.
Yeah,
that's interesting. If you try to extrapolate that though, like what hardware releases could they make in October that would make that timely? That if there are features that are coming out in Ventura that are also mirrored in iPadOS and they weren't available in iPadOS 16, if they're releasing 16.1 on the third week of October, does that not imply that Ventura will be coming out at around the same time? Or is that just ruthless speculation?
Well, I'm going to make a prediction that Stage Manager, which is, I think, the main reason that iPadOS hasn't come out and will be on Ventura, is going to be a miserable flop. I know you love it, Jason.
Love is too strong a word for it. And it is a mode. That's the beauty of it is it's a mode, so they can sort of leave it off and not even promote it and ship it and sort of work on it again. But
I think that's what Apple's hiding.
It's personally. A real niche.
I don't think they want to talk feature. About it. Yeah, I mean, I am all in on every operating system, Windows, Mac, and Linux, with workspaces. The idea that you have a whole screen with either one big window or a number of windows that you use. In fact, I'm using it right now. If I've got my browser in this screen, and you could show my screen real quick, John Ashley. So I got my browser there. I've got my copy there. I've got my Slack there. I've got the chat there. I've got the Discord there. There's an empty workspace. That's a really... And then I could see, you know, a virtual view of all the workspaces. That's a nice way to work. And I do that on the Mac, mostly full screen, but not always. And I do it on Linux. But I don't need Stage Manager to do this. So I'm all in on the idea of workspaces. I think that's a good thing. I think occupying a huge 10% of the screen with these chunks that show you the things you've got open in a workspace, well, that's not useful.
You can turn that off. I know, or move something over.
But
and
see,
it
look what
away.
I have here. I kind of have the same thing. This is how GNOME desktop in Linux does it. Microsoft Windows has a similar thing in the taskbar.
Sure.
That's fine for me. That's what Mac OS has Spaces thing. So mm-hmm. I think that's sufficient. So I'm wondering what problems Stages solves.
Well, it might just be as simple as there are people for whom Spaces is not an instinctive sort of way to manage their workflow. And that I have to admit that I am in that category. Like I see how right it is. I see how efficient it is, but I just can't get my mindset adapted to away from I have one window or a bunch of screens and I get to see all of my overlapping windows at the same time. I can't get my head into a certain space where all of my windows associated to a certain task always being in the same place. And there are very, very few apps for which operating them in full screen mode in their entire space makes more sense than just simply putting it somewhere in the scrum and then just command tabbing my way into it when I need it. So I love the fact that Apple is not necessarily saying that this is how things shall be from all day this day forward. Again, no insane billionaire megalomaniac disease here. It's like, no, we are keeping Spaces as it is. We're adding this other thing because people might have a better time with it. Particularly, I've played with it. I only have one iPad that can run the beta, so I don't have it installed on my iPad Pro. But I have used it, and I can see myself using that a lot on the iPad, where it's taking up a lot more of the screen relative to having this big, you know, my big Stonehenge array of screens in front of me right now. But it would help me to get around on that iPad a lot faster. So I'm really excited to see if I wind up using it a lot more than I would use Spaces once it finally gets released.
Yeah, I think the challenge on the iPad is how do you do windowing? Because there are multiple layers of windows is a very tried and true way of multitasking on the Mac and on Windows. And the iPad doesn't have that concept. It only has this sort of very simple tiling concept. I feel like Stage Manager, you know, as an organizational system is one thing, and then there's just multi-window on the iPad is the other part of this. And it has some use on iPad Pro, especially the larger one. On an external display, you really have to have floating windows because tiling on a large external display, you're going to have these huge apps and it doesn't really make any sense. I think the challenge is that they have to invent a windowing system on the iPad that doesn't exist. And then it's all yoked to Stage Manager, which is not fully formed even itself in terms of the keyboard shortcuts and showing and hiding things. And actually, my biggest frustration with Stage Manager on iPad is they said, let's do freeform windows, but not too freeform. So you can't actually put the window where you want it to go.
Exactly.
It moves it around. Yeah. And I don't understand why you would even bother with freeform windows if they can't be freeform. Then why didn't you just do a tiling system? On the Mac, Stage Manager has a different problem, which is this larger problem of Stage Manager, which is, you know, I think it's too complicated. I think you end up spending too much time moving windows around and managing windows instead of doing your work. And if it's supposed to be saving me time, it should make it, you know, I shouldn't click a link and have it open in a different place. Spaces is like this too, by the way. And then you're like, well, wait a second, but I was working over there and now I'm over here. And then you have to switch back and then you have to move that one and drag it back in. And you're doing all this window management. It's like, well, you know what I'm really good at is having all the windows open at once and then clicking on the one I want, which is how the Mac has worked since 1984.
Yeah. One thing that I think that a lot of OS makers and interface makers are becoming aware of, that there is such a variety of neurodivergency amongst users, that what if someone has ADHD to one degree or another? What if people have problems observing, basically tracking the movement of a moving object from one space to another, or even have a problem with I don't want to say object permanence because that's a specific term, but that's the sort of thing I'm talking about, where, wait a minute, I was here and now I've been teleported to this other place. Where am I relative to where my workspace was that other time? And now rather than simply saying, here is your burger, go ahead and eat it, you have to basically say, we're going to give you lots of different solutions to the problems of managing 8, 9, 10, 11 tasks across 10 or 20 different apps and windows. We're going to let you find your own solution to the thing. I mean, oddly enough, I don't think that tiling on the iPad is a terrible idea. I like the fact that I can have multiple views and not have to keep managing, keeping all both of these apps and both these functions visible at the same time. I actually, I have like a system extensions that will on my Mac that let me just get a copy that Windows behavior of if I drag this to the edge, it will just simply snap to one half of the of this display. I would love to have a tiling window manager for the Mac. I would probably use Spaces if I had access to. In this space, all windows do not overlap. They automatically tile, and it's very, very easy to basically pocket something into one quarter of the screen by simply dragging it into place. It's not a simple thing, and I don't expect Apple to solve Stage Manager in the first release. I hope that they keep nurturing it and keep developing it and listening to people, because a year from now, 2 years from now, it could be absolute Tabasco for the Mac.
And I think that it'll be interesting to see how many people use it. Like, I don't use Spaces at all. Like, I don't like it, you know, and I don't, so it doesn't mean anything. Like, a lot of this stuff, I'm like, okay, well, I mean, I like to be able to split my screen on my iPad occasionally, but outside of that, you know, I don't even like notifications. So I think that I'm very curious to see, you know, what the uptake, you know, is in general of the average user. So we have a lot of these things for power users, and I'm going to guess that from my own experience and people I've talked to, that it's actually a pretty small percentage of the overall users use a lot of this feature specifically.
Even on a laptop, I use full screen and workspaces all the time, but I don't go into Spaces because unless I need to figure out where something is or drag it around.
The only time I end up in Spaces is by accident, and then I'm always like,
how do I get back and how do I delete all this whatever. Yeah, I only do it once in a while when I have to. I'm just going back, control left right arrow, going back and forth.
So we have a large diversity of opinion here about these features, and we are a group of older white men, right? So not a lot of demographic diversity here, and yet I think four really different features.
I think we're all power users is what's
and that's well no but and yet some power users are like super into Spaces, and I hate Spaces and wouldn't use them if you force them on me. And I think this is one of the challenges in saying, well, how is Stage Manager, does it succeed or does it fail? And the answer is, I think even if it succeeds, only about 5% of the users will use it, right?
Like, because I think the real risk is that Apple's put a lot of attention on it and it's clearly troubled. That's why they had to push back iPad OS. They've got to release it now, if they release new iPads. And I think it may not be ready. Federico Vicici, trying the new beta, tweeted this morning, there are all sorts of problems with it. And this beta's got to be close to the final release, if not
feels
the
like
final
it.
Release.
Yeah. It feels like it. I mean, the good news for Apple is that it's a mode that's off by default. And I think that is good for them. That's very, very good. And that they took the external display support out, and that might seem a little weird, but I actually think Stage Manager is best on an external display. So they're actually reducing the chance that somebody is going to encounter Stage Manager unawares in any scenario or be motivated to use Stage Manager, and that gives them a little breathing room, I think.
Yeah.
And this is another illustration of why I have very few like triggering phrases when it comes to like discussion of tech topics, is like when someone dismisses someone's complaint, it's like, oh, nobody uses that feature, or nobody uses a computer that way, or nobody does that anymore. It's like that I have like a macro inside my head says, no, I don't think the word nobody means what you think it means. I think you think it means I personally don't use it this way, and therefore it's not important to me. And when it comes to something like a windowing manager, it doesn't matter that if it were true that 5%, not that anyone suggested that in this conversation, but like even if we had numbers saying, oh, well, only like 8% people actually use Spaces, that's great for that 8%. Let's keep it in there so that those 8% really have a method of working with their Mac that absolutely speaks to them and makes things easier for them. So it's in lieu of a Linux like situation where I can basically install the Windows manager that speaks to me, I'm glad that Apple is looking at alternative ways. They're not just simply saying, again, coming down from the mountain with these two tablets saying, behold, the only thing greater than yourself, this new windowing manager that you're all going to be forced to use anymore. I think it's going to be wonderful if Apple gives people those kind of options.
I think Stage Manager is the answer to the question, what is Apple hiding? Okay, I'm just going to say it. And if not, they ought to be. So do not take your iPhone or Apple Watch on a roller coaster, apparently, because 911 is going to get called a whole spate of 911 calls from people riding roller coasters. According to the Wall Street Journal, it looks like you've been in a crash. No, I've just been riding the Mystic Timber roller coaster. I think one 911 system said we got six calls today. six calls today from the roller coaster. So, yeah, the Warren County Communications Center provided me the recording of six iPhone crash detection calls from people at King's Island rides, all received since the new iPhone 14 went on sale in September. So not all in one day, but still, that you know, that's a burden on the call detector. And the reason, of course, is if you notice it, you can stop it. But if it's in your pocket and you're screaming and you got your hands in the air, it may call 911 for you.
There was someone in office hours we were talking about, I think this morning, that they broke their ankle in a couple of places and were in so much pain that they didn't respond to the, you know, there's, I think it was a biking accident, but didn't respond to their watch, and someone came to pick them up, you know, and they were very glad that someone came. So, you know,
I should mention there have been lives saved. Well, yeah. There was one crash in Texas where everybody died in the crash. Nobody could call emergency services, but it was called by the iPhone. Right. So, I mean, I don't know.
So, I think that this stuff, you know, this is teething pains. I mean, obviously, they're going to realize that if you're at Kennywood, you probably aren't going to be in a crash, or if you're at Six Flags or whatever, you're on the racer or whatever, you know, or Thunderbolt. And so, which Thunderbolt would feel like you're in a crash. I grew up in Pittsburgh. It feels like you're in a crash the whole time.
Wooden roller coaster where there's still you're paying extra for those bounces. Yeah.
Can Apple fix this? Is there an update?
I'm sure that they can fix it. I mean, this is they can. I think that eventually they're going to start to realize, like, if you're bouncing up and down, on a regular basis, you're probably on a trampoline. I can probably ignore that. If you're bouncing on, now what happens if you bounce off the trampoline and hit your head, which happens to a lot of people.
True.
It would be nice to send someone. So it's a little, it gets complicated. I think that they're going to err on the side of we're going to call somebody, because what you don't want is the article of I had the watch and it didn't do anything. And that type of thing is less exciting. Yeah. And but I think that knowing that once you're in the perimeter of a roller coaster area, you may not be in a car crash. You know, it might be.
Yep.
Oh, that's one way to do it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, just location.
Although at the same time, if somebody falls off the roller coaster,
right,
you want to respond. So
it's not a crash, though. That's not a crash.
Yeah.
Not
apparently, a crash. The problem on the roller coasters is on some roller coasters, I don't know, I don't go on them, they have very sudden deceleration. They go from 40 to miles an hour to zero in a second or two. I don't. Mm-hmm. And so that's apparently where it's going off.
They should be able to fix it. During my briefing, I asked them like what the difference was in implementation, say, between their crash detection and the Android crash detection that's been around for a few years. And their answer was basically that we think that our sensors are a lot more finer tuned and that they can inform our algorithms, our machine learning model, a lot better. So it seems as though, if you work at Apple, you might be sent out for a week to ride roller coasters with a couple of special iPhones in your pockets looking to collect more data and train the new machine language model. So good luck to you. That's going to be awesome.
Welcome back to the laptop. Apple is rebranding notebooks as laptops. Did you see this story?
Yeah.
That's I remember when we went to notebooks.
Yes.
That was a big thing. Now Apple, this is from 9to5 Mac today. If I could pull it up. I'm having trouble pulling it up. Apple is rebranding their stuff as laptops. Where is that? On the website?
Someone noticed that it wasn't an announcement or anything. They just noticed that all across the website, they're not what used to be referred to as notebooks are now laptops. They have a screenshot of which laptop is right for you. And here's the MacBook Air, the MacBook Pro, the other MacBook Pro.
There you go.
So yeah, that's as soon as I saw that headline, I was thinking, yeah, that makes sense. A, because I tend to see laptop used more than notebook, even though I do think they're synonyms, but also that with the range of products that Apple comes out with, it's kind of important for them to really put a hard edge between this is a laptop. You should anticipate a keyboard and a screen separated by a mechanical hinge. This is a notebook. They're all things that could be used as notebooks. Particularly with all the apps that we're making cross-platform right now. But who knows? It could just be because
that's the change. So it used to say which. So they expressly changed notebook to laptop. That's really interesting. And they went from Mac notebook to which laptop? Well, obviously you're here for a Mac, so we don't need to say that. I think notebook was a rebranding attempt to emphasize how thin and light they were, right?
I can't even remember. I can't even remember when that rebranding was.
I feel like this is since the Mac Portable that they went to the PowerBook. It was a notebook, and they chose a metaphor that is not. Part of me thinks that this is a diabolical plan, and they've got some naming thing in the works. But part of me thinks this is SEO. This is search engine optimization, where somebody came into a meeting and said, "I know that for 25 years we've referred to all of our laptops as notebooks. However, I'm going to tell you, people search for notebook at a quarter of the time as they search for laptop, and it's killing us not having laptop in there. We've got book in there, but we don't have lap or top. So let's throw them in there." And we'll get more results and hooray. And like, because what was that meeting where they said, yes,
exactly.
Let's do it. Sweep it all away. Notebooks out, laptops in. There's got to be a reason.
If they put money and time into answering this question. This wasn't just you know what? That kind of makes sense. Let's do that. It was great. You've got 3 months and $80,000 to study this idea. And they were able to, and there is a number somewhere in a document that says, here's how much money it's costing us by saying notebook instead of laptop.
Dell calls them laptops. I feel like, though, a lot of PC manufacturers adopted notebooks. But I guess they're laptops again. Maybe they didn't want to use the word lap. I don't know.
Oh, I'm getting it. I got it.
Are you getting another? Are you in an accident?
No.
Is this show moving too fast for you, Andy?
I got a Twitter message, instant direct message from somebody, and I'm trying to figure out whether this is a joke or not.
So you do the research.
I'm going to follow up on this.
Maybe they got an invitation to an Apple event. I don't know. What is Apple hiding?
I'll say that it's the reason why I have to figure out if this is a joke or not is because, he says, I know this on fact, says Jason O'Grady.
Okay.
I'm going to check up on
will
this.
You check it while I read it? I'll tell you a little story.
I will ask him for a citation on what he's saying.
Good. This is called journalism. It's happening before your eyes, ladies and gentlemen, or before your ears. About 1993, Steve Wozniak was flying to Tokyo, had a little time on his hands. He said, I ran Mavis Beacon Teaches Typing in Dvorak mode. I spent 5 hours learning the Dvorak keyboard and never again looked at a QWERTY keyboard. That's all it took. My son had already switched over successfully and learned Dvorak in a short time. I quickly got up to speed. He typed in QWERTY in about a week. Woz says, what I liked most about Dvorak was the feeling of using less energy with your fingers. Since iPhones came, Woz says, I had to resort to QWERTY, but it wasn't in my brain anymore. I'd been a very fast QWERTY typist my whole life. Now it's gone. I have to look at the letters on my iPhone. Steve Wozniak, channeling, not Steve Jobs, says, OMG, thank you very much, Apple. The Dvorak keyboard comes to the iPhone. Woo! I think he's the only person cheering this, I'm thinking. But anybody here type in Dvorak mode? Ashley, are you a Dvorak typist? No.
I type in the ancient form of hunt and peck.
Me too. Two finger, baby.
It's like I like to call it the claw.
But I'm tempted now. Maybe I should learn Dvorak. I didn't realize the iPhone had.
I have to do something completely different. The problem is I learned how to program before we had high school classes about it.
Yeah.
And so the problem is the muscle memory was so there, and I could not go back. When I listen to my wife type it at like 150 words a minute, like I go, I should really think about going back and learning how to do that, but I don't think I will.
All right. So that's a minor thing, and I think probably nobody cares, but the Dvorak keyboard, which is not the Dvorak keyboard, because that would let you compose symphonies.
For the new world only.
Oh, for the new world
old
only.
Old world, yeah. Not allowed, yeah.
Apple owns 40% of the fast-growing pre-owned smartphone market. Isn't that interesting? This comes from Counterpoint Research. Big chunk compared to even Samsung, Huawei, Oppo, Vivo, and then all the rest. 40%. That, I think, says more about, if anything, says more about the cost of Apple phones than anything else. But that they keep their value, I would guess, quite well. I know probably most of my family, I mean, I think about it, is using hand-me-downs, right? So, any word yet, Andy Inako, from this giant scoop?
not a giant scoop. If those people will recognize the name Jason O'Grady, he was like one of the he is a very, very good, very, very smart guy. He created the O'Grady's Power Page.
The Power Page. Like
oh,
yeah.
I remember the O'Grady Power Page. Yeah.
Hang on. I'm going to officially like message him and say, is it okay if I repeat this on the show?
Okay, so go ahead. Message it.
I mean, he's listening, so he's probably about to say yes or no.
Mr. O'Grady, may we use your name in vain?
And tear down this wall.
Tear down. No, that's a different mister.
Oh, sorry.
let's see. I think I'm done with stories here. So I'll tell you what, while you're working this story, I will give a plug for Club Twit, because it's become more and more important to us.
Go for it, he says.
Go for it? All right, what is the news?
Okay, so he says that when it was changed to notebook, it was done by legal. Because of the heat generated by the laptops, Apple did not want to endorse a piece of hardware that could burn your lap. He says,
my God.
He says he knows this on fact, not joking. I was told this by sources at the time, and he distinctly remembers this change being a technical writer. And his theory agrees with ours that it seems that the Apple changed it back to laptop now due to SEO reasons. But the original reason why they became notebooks was because notebooks, because they did not want a really, really super hot Intel or PowerPC powered device they're making on people's lap. I can actually, that does sound credible, because I remember, like there's probably still like a scar like on the inside of my ankle, like when I was sitting cross-legged on a sofa, there would be a section of my MacBook that would get so excruciatingly hot that I would put like a towel underneath it to prevent myself from getting burned. So he says he needs to get to a keyboard to be able to like link to a source or something on this, but
makes perfect sense. They didn't want to say lap, because then if you got burned, they're liable. That makes perfect sense.
I guess this means Apple Silicon success story, right?
Yeah, another Apple Silicon success story. They're laptops again. Put it in your laptop.
Bottom temps were over 120 degrees on Intel. Thank you. Thanks, Jason.
Like,
this is why I say there's some names where like that catches my, when I get a direct message from someone like Jason, that gets my immediate attention, because like he probably knows what he's doing, and he probably has had this from experience. I'm not going to repeat that before asking some follow-up questions. So
Thank you, Jason. By the way, O'Grady's Power Page lives still at powerpage.org. So Jason, we're going to get Jason O'Grady on the show sometime. That's awesome. It says he's now a Googler, so I guess that's interesting. So Power Page, which was according to him, the second Mac blog, started in 1995.
Yeah, no, this is probably like the first, one of the first URLs you probably, one of the reasons why you installed Mosaic probably was because, Mac Week is once again quoting this Power Page thing. Oh, maybe I should get a slip account and figure out how to use this internet thing.
I'm going to add Power Page. Let's see if they have an RSS feed, because I'm going to add them to my Sumi News RSS feeds, because I want to be following everything Jason writes, and we should. Yes, I am. You're now in my RSS feed. Thank you, Jason. Glad to know you listen. And that's a great memory.
We all have a lot of these stories where it's things that we have been told that are just been filed away, and it came from a really, really good source, but we never wrote about it, or we never, can you commit this to an interview so we can actually like publish this? But then it just never happened. But it becomes part of the cultural history that needs to be passed along.
Yep. Awesome. I was starting to give a plug to our very special Club Twit, a club that wants you as a member. We would love to have you as a member of Club Twit. It is one of the ways we support ourselves, and it's becoming more and more important, especially as we head into, I hate to say it, a recession, and advertisers are getting a little skittish about advertising on podcasts. We need to make up that revenue to keep the lights on, to keep the shows flowing. And the best way to do it, I think, is going right to our listeners. $7 a month, that's all it costs for ad-free versions of all of our shows. You also get access to the Discord, which is wonderful, where you'll see Jason Snell typing in Dvorak or something.
Yeah, nonsense words.
Is that? Oh, I thought it was Latin for a bit. Or maybe Welsh. I don't know. The Discord is a place to hang, not just during the shows, but all sorts of conversations about every possible topic, plus a Twit Plus feed, where shows that we have not yet developed sufficiently to put out into the public can be heard, like our Hands on Mac show with Micah Sargent, which is really excellent. Hands on Windows with Paul Thurrott. If you're a Windows lover, you're going to love this one. The Untitled Linux Show, a little near and dear to my heart, with Jonathan Bennett. Stacy's Book Club, lots of stuff going on. That's where we launched this, so to speak, This Week in Space, and it did become public. So the club members subsidize these new shows, and so we really appreciate it. For those of you who are club members, thank you. And for those of you who aren't, we are special. Please go to twit.tv/clubtwit. I will be very, very grateful. It really has made a big difference for us. And going forward, I mean, to be frank, if you see a future for Twit 3, 4, 5 years from now, I think it will be because Club Twit has kept us going. So it's important. Thank you. Let us get to our picks of the week. Let me start with you, Jason Snell.
All right, I am going to go a little bit off the beaten path, and I'm going to pick an e-reader because I do love reading, and I love reading books in electronic format, and I'm not going to pick a Kindle.
What?
I'm
going
to pick the Kobo
the
Libra
say?
2.
It kind of looks like a
Libra
Kindle. I bought a Kobo because you get library books on it, right?
Yeah, you can get library books on the Kindle too, but the Kobo is directly integrated with OverDrive, so you can even search for your library books on there. You can return them right on there. You don't have to go through a second app or a second process like you do
really
with Kindle.
I really like that, yeah.
This is the Libra 2. It's $180. And that I'll point out that's $100 less than the cheapest Kindle that has physical page turn buttons. This has physical buttons you click to turn the page, which for me is how I prefer to read a book, instead of every page moving my finger over and covering the text that I'm reading and tapping and then moving it off. I like just resting my finger on the button and then you press next.
I like
and
that
you go
too.
To the next page.
Yeah.
It's real good. Yeah. And it's why Amazon thinks this is a premium feature, I don't know, but the Libra has it for $100 less, and that's $100 less than the Kindle Oasis with ads. There are no ads on the Kobo, so it's $120 less than the one without ads.
And you can read it underwater, which is awesome.
It's all, you know, it's all waterproof. It's not
actually
as,
for vacation, it's a good idea.
It is. It's great for Bath or Beach. Yeah. And also one of the things, I mean, look, it's $100 less, and it's all plastic. It doesn't have, like, the metal back like the Kindle Oasis or all, any of that. But it's a good, solid e-reader, and it's got... You know, it's waterproof backlighting. It's got a really nice little adjustable backlight where if you run your finger up the corner of the screen, the backlighting goes up or down. You don't have to go to an interface to do it to, you know, again, try to minimize the amount of time you're using a computer interface when you're reading a book. I like it a lot. I think the software is superior to Amazon software.
Now,
much as it was a year ago.
You have to buy books from the Kobo store?
Yes, you do. The Kobo store has all the same books that the Kindle store has for basically the same price.
Okay.
And I know when I talk to people about this and they're like, yes, but I bought some Kindle books. Well, Buying a Kobo doesn't mean you have to throw away your old Kindle. You could keep it around. And also, there's software for that. I'll just mention, I know it's been mentioned on the show in the distant past, but Caliber.
Love
is
Caliber.
Is a free open source project that runs on the Mac and many other platforms that will load things onto a Kobo just as easily as a Kindle. If you've got EPUBs, it'll load them right on. There's a special extended Kobo version of EPUB that makes them all pretty on the Kobo. And that's there's a plugin that's built into Caliber for that. And if you've got old Kindle books that have DRM on them, you can get them. You can use the DDRM tools, which are widely available on the web as a plugin for Caliber from Apprentice Alf. That's his name. And those will pull the Kindle DRM off. And then you can just put them on your Kobo that way if you really want to do that. But in terms of library books and new books, I've just been using the Kobo store and Overdrive, and it's been great. And I think it's the best deal going in ebook readers right now, especially if you want those physical page turn buttons.
I was, I bought it because of the library. In fact, I went out and got a library card and everything, because I think that's what a great way, seamless way to borrow library books. And then I just didn't use it that much, so I sent it to Stacy, and I don't think Stacy likes it because she never talks about it. So I might ask her back, back, because waterproof is great. It's 300 PPI, which is just as good as a Kindle. It's got backlight, 7 inches, 32 gigs, which is a lot for an e-reader.
It's for books. It is. Yeah. I mean, it's not for comics or PDFs or anything like that. It's the smaller one, but for novels. And I know there are a lot of people who watch and listen to this show who probably say, well, why wouldn't you just use your iPad? And the answer is I really like not being distracted when I'm reading a novel, especially. I like not being distracted. And the Kindle and the Kobo, they, you know, for better or worse, they don't have an app store, essentially. So they just do what they do, which is you're reading text on a page. Yeah, it's black and white or grayscale in this case. It doesn't matter. It's just text on a page. The contrast
better,
is pretty good.
Some would argue.
Yeah. And I love it. So this is how I read. And I read, 50 or 60 books a year. And this is how I do it.
Wow. Yeah. That's great.
Well, yeah. I agree. I gotta jump on and say I agree with you 100% that I have most of us on this conversation, I have a bunch of iPads, so I can have beautiful book reading experiences, but I still have a 8-year-old Kindle that I sometimes take with me because, number one, I don't run down the battery the way I would do on the iPad, which is something that I need to have that battery for actual work later in the day. But also there are times where I'm in New York for a few days. I know that all I'm going to do is I'm going to be riding in and out of town to go hang out with people and have events. I don't need to have an iPad with me, but I do need something to read on the way in and out of town. And having the separate little device with a 30-hour battery in it and a much better experience, which if it gets stolen out of my hands on the subway as someone rushes out, is not going to really kill me to lose like a $180 thing versus my $1,000 iPad. I kind of rediscovered it. I stopped using it like 3 years ago, but then when I was cleaning the office like about 2 or 3 months ago, I rediscovered it and said, why did I stop using this?
I have to say, battery life alone. I have left more than one Kindle in the back of a airplane seat, however.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Same. Okay. Same. But and Andy's exactly right. The battery life thing is such a great thing that you can charge this thing up and turn off the Wi-Fi, and it will last for weeks.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's and so anyway, yeah, if you've never done it, I would say give the Kobo some consideration, or if you've got an older one, the quality of the screens has gotten a lot better, and the backlighting, it's side lighting, but you know what I mean. It lights itself now. The old ones didn't do that. I used to have to clip a book light onto my Kindle, and
it was
the dumbest.
Was awful.
Why would
I
you
used
even
to too, yeah.
But they solved all of that stuff, and Amazon, Amazon may come out with some new Kindle hardware that beats this, and they've made strides on the software side. Their software is not as far behind Kobo as it used to be, but I have the Kindle Oasis that costs $120 more than this, and I don't use it. I use this one instead.
Yeah. I might have to buy another one. you're a good salesman. Thank you, Jason.
I like it.
The other thing that set me off a little bit is Rakuten bought them, and that made me a little nervous too.
Yeah, and didn't they? I think they've spun them off now,
no,
or maybe they spun
says,
off over.
Still says no, they, Rakuten they,
yeah, they're,
Kobo.
They're Rakuten and That's right, and they did spin off Overdrive, but the connection is still there with Overdrive and Kobo readers. The other weird thing is their deal with Walmart. If you're somebody who doesn't like Walmart, it's kind of funny that when you log in to Kobo, they're like, "Would you like to log in with Walmart?" And you're like, "No, I don't want to do that. I want to log in with my my Rakuten Kobo ID instead. But it's a good, like, and I'm glad that they still exist, right? Because this is one of those categories that Amazon could have just swallowed whole, and everything's a Kindle and they have no competition at all. And I, what I learned when I tried the Kobo out is that they do have competition, and Amazon really let their software get real bad. Yeah. And they were really embarrassed by the Kobo software. They are better now. The Amazon really did do a good update on the Kindle software last year.
Competition's good.
It is good.
Andy Iannacco, pick of the week.
Pick of the week is an unusually good deal on a very good pair of in-ear monitors. They're not earbuds. They're in-ear monitors. The Edemonic Research ER3SE Studio Edition earphones. They're available most places for $150. You can get them cheap for like $90 to $100. But Adorama is having on like a 1 day or 2 day sale at 66% off for just $50.
Wow. That's and a good price. These are great headphones. They sound very
they really are, especially if, like, I like the style of headphones where as you can see by the ear tips, earplug type ear tips. These absolutely seal the world away from your entire head, which means that they're really, really bad if you're on a bicycle. You don't want to be wearing this while you're on a street where there is traffic. But it's the sort of design where noise cancellation almost doesn't enter into it because noise is just not going to get into it. And they're very, very high quality audio as well. I've never had this pair, this model of Edemonic Research earphones, but I have had other Edemonic Research earbuds, and boy, they are wired, by the way. They are really, really good, high quality stuff. And for $49, I almost just went ahead and bought a pair, and I got as far as the great complete purchase button, filling out everything before I realized that, Andy, you have a pair of really good, like the sort of like in-ear wired headphones, in addition to two pairs of wireless earbuds and two pairs of really good, like, over-the-head headphones you like. This is a phenomenal deal, but do you, and I have said, okay, you're right, Dad. I'm sorry. Thank you for being the voice in my head that prevents me from spending money stupidly. But for anybody who does not have earphones like this, really, really good deal. It's only we're recording on Tuesday the 11th. I think it's a 2 day sale today and tomorrow. But as of like an hour before the show recorded, they still had plenty, and I was able to very nearly complete an order. So you should be able to get in on it.
These are Edemonic makes a variety of headphones, some lower end, but these are their high end, high quality. The ER3SEs are very, very high quality. And as you point out, normally $150, so getting them for $50 is quite a deal. Yeah.
Even on Amazon, the cheapest price is $92, and that's not available
Adorama
everywhere.
Adorama has them. $50.
This is a genuine deal. Yep.
Yeah. I remember actually crying when I got on an airplane and realized I'd forgotten my Edemotics. I was going to have to listen to a baby and people and all that stuff. Oh, it's not a good experience. It's nice to have them. Thank you, Andy. And now to Alex Lindsay for his pick of the week.
So a couple of weeks ago, I talked about Zoom ISO, and today we're going to see the next piece of that, which is called IzzyCast. This is not from Zoom. This is from a company called Troikatronics, and they make Isadora, which I've talked about in the past.
Oh, yeah, Isadora.
And So the Isadora is basically a low-code programming environment that lets you very used in a lot of theater. So I want to have all the lights do this, and I want to have this, and I want to respond possibly to motion capture, and I want to have all these other bits and pieces that are all tied together. So you can build these interactive events for theater, and more of us have been starting to use Isadora. In fact, Office Hours runs on Isadora. Like, it's just the whole core of it is all running there.
And you're making Zoom calls, but Isadora is
we make Zoom calls. We use Zoom ISO to go out of Zoom and then put it into our switcher, and then we have Isadora running everything. So Isadora is running the graphics, it's running the switcher, it's running all those other bits and pieces. And so it makes sense that what they're doing now is going to what IzzyCast. Now, what this does is it sits on top of the Zoom SDK. So this allows them, Zoom is now making it available where people can build whatever they want on top of Zoom. So you're not using the Zoom interface, you're not logging into Zoom, you're not doing anything else. It's just using the video architecture that Zoom's built. And so what IzzyCast is doing here is passing audio, video, and data back and forth between two locations that are hundreds of miles apart, but they could be anywhere in the world. But again, it's still using Zoom to transport it, which means that you don't, if you're developing this yourself, you would have to deal with firewalls and all the infrastructure and updates and all those other things. And what they're doing is taking what they do well, which is this larger low code interface and just adding some nodes that are like, I want to go get video. I want to go get data, you know, or I want to send data or send video. And that's all all you have to add are these little nodes that then can be part of the larger interface. And so, what you saw in that video is there's just a simple something someone opens and now they're able to send video, send audio, even send data, you know, back across, back to Isadora, which then allows it to do all the other things that Isadora does already. And so the real advantage there is that you can now very easily build your own solution. So if you don't like the way Zoom works, like this is something that eventually somewhere in the future, you could have Twit just send out a little something for someone to open. They open it up and it just grabs video and audio, and you could even have it have an interface where you could send back notes to us or all kinds of other things. You don't have to figure out how to make that work in Zoom. It just works on either end. And so it's pretty, I mean, we're starting to really see the idea of interactive video start to become much more accessible. And by having it in a low code environment, it means you can think about things and just draw nodes as opposed to trying to write, you know, Swift or Objective-C or anything else to make this actually work. So it's a really interesting, and we're going to be playing with it a lot. It's not released yet, so this is just a kind of a preview of it, but we're really excited about it. And again, it's partially because we already use the Zoom ISO architecture to get all of our video in and out of stuff. It's a pretty interesting technology coming out.
Where do I go to get Isadora?
Troikatronics. Troikatronics is the name.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so that's
is a beta. This is not yet available.
It's in beta. Yeah, you'll probably see more of it. It'll probably get released as beta in November, and probably won't be until early next year. But it's something that if you're doing video production, if you're especially at a broadcast level, this is something you want to start paying attention to. And right now, literally, there's a couple movies. So there's an hour where we talk to Mark Coniglio, who is the founder of Troikatronics, as well as Andy Carluccio from Zoom. About what the development is. So we did that last Friday, so you can go look at that video and watch an hour of us talking about it. But I got a bunch of pings on a couple of social networks after they saw it, just from broadcasters that are just like, oh, okay, now I'm thinking about what I can do with this. Yeah. And the cool thing is that with this SDK, you know, the IzzyCast is going to make it a lot easier to integrate it with Isadora, but anybody could use the SDK. So you know. Probably next year, we're going to see stuff, you know, it could be incorporated into Memo Live or vMix or Ecamm or, you know, like a lot of those things. Because right now, everybody's been rolling their own and it's been a kind of a disaster, you know. And so this is making it a lot easier to make that actually work. So anyway, so it's a pretty slick system. And it really shows the possibility of kind of building your own interface and your own back and forth. And again, I think that Twit may end up eventually might make sense to use either Zoom ISO or Isadora or this solution to totally own the connection between us on the edge and the studio.
I obviously would love to do that if I could understand a word you're saying, but if somebody must.
Right now, I mean, right now, the big thing is that you're, you know, right up until recently, we were basically getting on Zoom and then screen scraping Zoom into a, you know, from a Zoom room or whatever onto, you know, into our systems. And then we can edit between people and everything else. And now
what I need to solve really is a way to have a show and then have people call into the show. And have a lobby or something. You do this on office hours.
We do that all the time.
And so they're sitting in the lobby and then they're invited up on a stage. But I want to be able to do that with minimal personnel. Like I'd be able, right. You know, I'd like to be able to say, okay, let's take this person and bring them up onto the stage. We could do that in Discord, but it's right now you can only do about 40 people at a time.
Yeah. And it's
not
pretty easy
quality.
To do that. And it's something that you can literally, now that could be something that if you want to start using breakout rooms and putting people into prep and everything else, then Zoom ISO is probably the thing you want to do because you can have Zoom ISO sitting there and just go hit a stream.
I don't want to have to have a call screener. I want to kind of have it so that I can give out a number that you can call in and you'd be part of a room. Preferably, one of the other things I realized is the biggest problem we have when we try to take calls in Discord is people don't have the setup. I want to do it from a phone and just say, here's a, wouldn't be necessarily a number, but a link that you do on your phone. Because you've got a camera and a microphone that work pretty darn well, and you could actually participate on the phone. So I wanted to have that so they can call in from their phone somewhere, and then we can put them on the air to take questions and comments and things like that. And we've been doing it with Discord. It doesn't work that well, so I need something.
No, you could literally have a touchscreen where you just see them coming in on their phone and just tap on it. I want that person. And then it would bring that person right into the show.
And do I need Isadora to do that, or can I do that just with
Zoom? No, you could do that with Zoom. You could do that with Zoom ISO. Yeah. Well, we'll absolutely. But for those of us who are building,
we have
really
to hire
stuff,
you is what we have to do, Alex, and that's all.
Yeah.
That's all.
So I think that it's a we'll talk. I don't need to be hired, but I can help.
So here's another entreaty to join Club Twit, cuz we probably can't afford
Alex,
but with your help.
Exactly. Exactly.
We can book 1 hour in which we get lots of questions in.
Well, I would like to do a show kind of like the radio show where we take questions, but we're gonna need club support to do it, because I don't think we can. I think we need the infrastructure to make that work.
Finally, 838 episodes later, the plan to get Alex involved in the production of Backbreak Weekly.
Oh, he's been involved in the past.
It was a long seduction, but the perfume of Leo Laporte.
I've been consulting Alex for 17 years. Believe me. From day one, you know, Alex has been a great, I mean, I am not kidding. I've been a great resource for all this. A lot of times what Alex does is the high price spread I can't afford. But
I think you'll find, we'll figure out how to use it. I don't think it would cost that much.
Yeah, could be
Zoom
great
ISO
for
thing
us.
Is not expensive.
Everybody wonders why we step on each other, but we're on separate Zoom calls.
Yeah,
so we're
yeah.
all like 2 seconds off from each other. Yeah,
right. We're all on the same call, but we had ISOs. Which is why we do it on separate machines right now. That you know, we've been doing it that way since Colleen built Skypeosaurus,
right,
which was 4 Mac Minis with Skype running individually, just so we'd have ISO. But now, if Zoom will let us do ISOs, then that solves the whole problem.
Well, and with Isadora, you could literally have heads up with Isadora and Izzycast. You can have heads up displays where you're typing in like, "Hey, something's over your shoulder. I need you to turn your whatever down," and all that stuff could be just showing up for us as a literally composited return from you as well. But with Zoom ISO, you could definitely just be grabbing all the things that you're talking about, and it's not particularly an expensive thing to do. So we'll talk more about it. But I think that it's
thank you.
It's the other thing that we're finding is that better color, better frame rate. So coming out of the SDI cards, because we're literally just pushing from Zoom ISO, and what we will be doing with Izzycast is pushing straight from the video coming into the computer straight to the Declan cards. So it's not screen scraping, which you lose some frame rate and quality on the way through.
So, John, I think you understand what he's saying. I hope to God somebody does. And
we'll talk. We'll
make
your
it
people
so.
Talk to my people. We'll figure it all out. Yeah,
this is what you get when you go to 090.media. You get Alex Lindsay and his incredible expertise. That's his day job. But in the early morning hours, you'll find him at office hours. .global talking about all kinds of fantastic stuff, just all the things Alex is kind of interested in, but
it's gotten way bigger than me. I don't even manage this. The second hours now are managed by a team, and they figure out what they want to talk about.
So
I come in the morning and go, "Well, what are we talking about today?"
So it's really
it's a huge group of volunteers that have kind of put this, that come together all over the world every day and have some great conversations. And so we spent an hour this morning talking about comms.
That's important in a studio. Yeah. You need comms, baby.
No, absolutely.
Nice. Go to officehours.global, sign up. You can register and join the discussion, which is great. And then, of course, you can always just watch it. They have YouTube and so forth. But officehours.global is the starting point. Thank you, Alex. Andy, when are you going to do a GBH next?
I was on last Friday. I'm off this week, but I'm on next week, my usual time and place, 12:45 on Friday at the Boston Public Library. You can watch it live, listen to it live, or later at WGBHnews.org. Go to YouTube, the YouTube's channel WGBH News, to watch and stream it live or later. I do have one important note. Apparently, that Etymonic Research headphones, the price is good. You have to use a special link, however, to get it. If you just go to Adorama.com, it will show you $150 price, a whopping $10 off. But I'm about to tweet out the link that I just gave in the show notes to make sure that the people actually get it. Apparently, it was available. The link was given away in email, but it works for anybody, whether you got the email or not.
Ah, so here's the deal. Follow Andy on Twitter. How do you spell Inatko? I have no idea. I-H-N-A-T-K-O. He's just at Inatko on the Twitter, and he'll be tweeting that out. And other things. He's a tweeter. And I love your picture carrying the portal gun in front of the Office of Science and Technology Policy.
That office has like a whole bunch of stuff on display, including like some pieces of spacecraft that are really, really very, very interesting, and the replica portal gun, and everybody wants to pose with a portal gun, myself included.
And I have to say, when I saw your Insta of this picture, I thought, wow, the timing on this was amazing. I was very impressed. And then I realized, you were using Midjourney to make this?
Nope, that was DALL-E 2.
DALL-E 2.
Using the infill feature
I love this, with the penguin on a skateboard and the raccoon trying to break in to the Mini Cooper. I mean, this is fine art.
And the squirrel enjoying coffee on the coffee shop.
Oh, I missed that. Wait a minute. There's the squirrel and the kitty looking at. All of that was added, huh? By DALL-E 2.
Yep.
Nice.
That was...
Well done.
they're going to get a lot of my money in the next month because there's a lot of time I need to waste in the office, and it's an excellent way to waste it. This tool.
What a great time waster, and what a great person to have on the show. Thank you, Andy.
Thank you.
And I want to know more about your watch. Did you get a Pixel 7 too?
I have the Pixel 7 Pro, and we should talk the camera. Quick take. Oh boy, the camera. And maybe if you want, we can talk about that next week or talk about it.
Mine will come. I ordered it as a real human. And it should be coming this week.
Yeah. Can I just say the very, very funny story? Ironic story. So of course I'm in New York City. I got to see what's playing at the Met that night. So of course I went to the Met, a Met opera performance that night. And I had really good house seats, like 10th row in. So I said, I bought the iPhone 14 Pro with me to take sample shots. Oh, wow. Great opportunity to take sample shots with the iPhone Pro. Unfortunately, they were both the iPhone and the new Pixel were in the same pocket. I took out the wrong camera, and I'm not allowed to post any of those pictures until tomorrow. So I couldn't even show to take pictures. I take pictures during the curtain calls only, and I got some great shots, but I can't share them.
Well, we'll see them tomorrow. Where will we see them? On your Twitter,
Instagram, Twitter, Flickr, and a couple other places. So
thank you for letting us know ahead of time. I can't wait.
Yes, you will enjoy them. I enjoy them as well.
Jason Snell rocks hard at sixcolors.com.
Oh, man, do I ever. And check out, I'm going to plug my podcast at theincomparable.com this time. It's my little pop culture podcast network. A lot of fun stuff over there. The Mothership Show every week. We do an actual play D&D podcast called Total Party Kill. That's pretty fun, and lots of places to jump in. And it is the only place, I think, that you can get an active, very funny Magnum P.I., old classic 80s Magnum P.I. podcast, which I do with David Lore and Philip Michaels, which is a kick because we just basically get on a Zoom call and drink beer and talk about old episodes of TV from, you know, the 80s.
Do you watch while you're...
Oh, we do.
Oh, you do?
No, not while we're doing it. We watch them beforehand.
Beforehand, and then talk about it.
It's just like all those cool after shows you have
these days. Yeah, I love those.
Where you're talking about modern shows, we just do it about Magnum P.I. from the 80s instead.
It's the after, like the deep after.
It's way after show. Yeah, it's extremely very far.
We watched it in 1992, and now we want to talk about it.
Yeah,
where do you find old episodes of Magnum? Who streams those?
I don't know where they are right now. I bought them on iTunes, but they are available. And I think they're on one of the fast... I don't know if they're on Pluto or somewhere, but they're around. And then we've got there's a show called The Complicated Profession that Dan Morin does with his wife and with Tony Sidelar, where they're talking about Star Wars. So they're talking about Andor right now. And we've got another show that's about all the MCU stuff. And so, if there's something
you said your little network, you've got 4, 8, 12, 16, 20, 24, 28, 32,
there's a lot of shows there,
35 shows
active
open to
shows.
The public, and then another 6 members only.
And some retired shows, too. Yeah, I mean, we're
Holy
busy.
Holy cow. It's bigger than Twit, folks. Hiding in plain sight at theincomparable.com. Holy cow. And it's all for nerds. Shows for nerds.
That's what it's for.
Wow. Pop culture podcast for nerds and fans hosted by, many of them hosted by this guy right here, Jason Snell. Always a pleasure having you on. Thank you, Jason.
Great being here.
You can get your quest back on and we'll see you in a
Excellent.
Week.
Excellent. Oh, so, yeah. Bye, everybody.
We thank you all for joining us each and every week for Mac Break Weekly. You can watch it with the ads in or ads out if you're members of Club Twit. For the add-in version, just watch the live stream on Tuesdays, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC, live.twit.tv. The public chat is irc.twit.tv. There's also, of course, ad-supported versions on our website, twit.tv/mbw. And on YouTube, there's a dedicated channel for Mac Break Weekly. If you have a podcast client, you can subscribe. And I think that's probably the best way to get it. So you get it automatically as soon as it's done. And if your podcast client allows you to leave reviews, please do us a solid. Leave us a 5-star review. Let the world know. We haven't been doing this show since 1995, like Jason O'Grady, but we've been doing it a long time. One of the oldest and best, if you ask me, Mac podcasts. Thanks, everybody, for being here. Now get back to work because break time is over. Bye-bye.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? I am Ant Pruitt, and I am the host of Hands-On Photography here on Twit TV. I know you got yourself a fancy smartphone, you got yourself a fancy camera, but your pictures are still lacking. Can't quite figure out what the heck shutter speed means? Watch my show. I got you covered. Want to know more about just the ISO and exposure triangle in general? Yeah, I got you covered. Or if you got all of that down, you want to get into lighting, you know, making things look better by changing the lights around you. I got you covered on that too. So check us out each and every Thursday here on the network. Go to twit.tv/hop and subscribe today.